at WRIF.com. Get your fix of the heaviest 60 minutes in the Motor City. It's Midnight Metal.
Is America a better place to live because of our efforts?
Tuesday through Thursday nights with Screaming Scott. From your home for Midnight Metal, the home of rock and roll. 101. The Riff.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We took calls on embarrassing things your kids said.
Yeah, I took my 6-year-old son in to get a haircut, so I'm sitting 2 chairs down from him. And, the lady that's getting cut in his hair has got kind of a complexion, her hair's all frizzed up, etc. And I'm getting my hair cut, and I hear him say, "You look like a monster."
I was about 16. I was living with my aunt, and she had 2 kids. They were my niece and nephew or cousin or something. But they're about 4 years old, and she was friends with these 2 girls named Michelle. And one of them was fat, and one of them was skinny. So I used to decipher them by, you know, saying Fat Michelle or Skinny Michelle. Well, one day, one of the Michelles came to the door. Needless to say, it was the big one, and kids with the memories they have.
Yeah.
Answers the door. My Fat Michelle's here!
Drew and Mike in the morning. Broadcast program. On the
opportunity to take control of the WRIF playlist
with the guy who lost control a long time ago.
Call in your Riff Rock and Roll requests to Meltdown at 313-298-WRIF or email them to meltdown@wrif.com.
The Riff and Rock at 9 o'clock with Meltdown.
He's in big trouble.
101. WRIF.
WRIF.com.
Hello.
What you missed. Number three is, though, I couldn't pick up any AM stations and didn't bring many cassettes, but I had this old Night Call tape. Those of you maybe just listening or have found this show on the internet, that's the name of this program, the Night Call program. He says, I think it was from the fall of 2002, certainly before the Iraq War. Well, my friend, you were so much calmer then. It is really unbelievable, he says. In fact, you are starting to have the rabid talk show host voice that you have for so long rebuffed. Well, I always used to talk about these right-wingers that they talk from their throat. If you remember 1984, and they talked about duck speak, that you spoke from your throat, and Limbaugh and all that. They always are talking like this. They're totally indignant about what the liberals are doing. Never from their heart, never from their diaphragm. Chris from Grosse Pointe, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, says, I'm getting just like him, that I've become a rabid talk show host, the type that I was always critical of. I'm thinking about that, Chris. But then, just after I read that, I read something in one of those wonderful English newspapers. I say wonderful because the English newspapers, like most countries that have real opposition presses. So they take on their government. They don't just roll over. They're not Pravda or Izvestia the way our newspapers and our television stations were and our cable and what have you in the run-up to the war. Oh, suddenly after they found out some things that were not quite, that didn't quite go down the way they reported. But then they blamed it all on Bush and on Rumsfeld. Remember Rumsfeld? You see him on television all the time. Remember that guy? Sort of messed everything up. Ooh, I almost said a bad one, didn't I? Well, I mean, that's closer to it. The bad one is what he really did. He was the guy that said we could go into Iraq with just a small number of people. There wouldn't be any problem with exiting almost 3 or 4 months. We could leave maybe 30,000 troops there. He said we'd be welcome. They'd be throwing flower petals in the street, not rocket-propelled grenades, but flower petals welcoming us, the U.S., as liberators. So here was somebody, Rumsfeld, that was so wrong. I mean, why isn't he fired? Anyway, so I'm doing what I always do, just completely discursive, not sticking on my point. So Chris from Grosse Pointe writes, 2002... My friend, you were so much calmer there. It's really unbelievable. You're starting to have that rabid talk show host voice that I once said was so terrible. Anyways, I was talking about one of these newspapers from England. We had papers like this here, there wouldn't have been a war in Iraq, because the papers there exposed the lies that Bush and Rumsfeld and Powell and the rest of Cheney, the rest of them all told. That's why in England the majority of people were against the war. That's the reason in Spain the majority of people were against the war, even though the prime ministers of those countries went along with Bush, because they're part of, just sort of the lapdogs of the big dog. I'm never going to make my point. Anyways, I got that voice, rabid talk show host. From the Independent in London, says, portrait, and they're talking about us, portrait of a country on the verge of a nervous breakdown. That's the headline in the Independent of London. Portrait of a country on the verge of a nervous breakdown. With only 9 days to go in the polls showing Bush and Kerry still neck and neck, the result is once again likely to turn on the minutiae of the voting system. But this time the whole country seems poised to descend into post-election chaos. Andrew Gumbel reports on the traumatizing effects of this bitter campaign and how, as the world's most powerful democracy talks of exporting freedom to Iraq, it is at the risk of becoming an object of international ridicule. We don't care. I don't care what they say about us in England. I don't care what they say about us in France. One of the hardest things to do is take criticism. It is for me. And I really practice at it. When someone, like Chris, when he writes in saying, I'm starting to sound like a rabid talk show host, I start thinking, well, am I? Am I really getting rabid? And if I am, I mean, why? But most of us, as soon as someone says, you're making a mistake, well, then we just circle the wagon drains, the iron curtain comes down, and anyone who dares to say we're making a mistake is our enemy. Bush is a lot like that. Remember they asked him, like, how many mistakes, or name three mistakes? Well, he's not going to name any, because people like that are incapable of admitting that they have made mistakes. I mean, in fact, this from... Let's see, where is this from? Oh, yeah, the University of Maryland's program on international policy attitudes polls people in terms of what attitudes they hold. Now, on planet Earth, we all know now there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That it was either, at best, totally bad information, and the people that created the information, that promulgated, that spoke out publicly in support of that information within the government, ought to be cashiered. Now, the president, if he made a mistake of such grand proportions, should just be defeated in the elections. The other guys should have been defeated. I'm sorry, should have been fired right away. I mean, just sort of booted out of there. I mean, they've made a mistake so bad that thousands and thousands of people have died. We took our eye off the target of Al-Qaeda and now are bogged down in this quagmire of Iraq. Soon, thousands and thousands of more of our troops and maybe tens of thousands of Iraqis are going to be killed because they're the rebels, right? They're the rebels against who? They're rebelling against the United States. Where does the United States live? Well, it's in a continent called America. But our soldiers are mistaken reason, 6,000 miles away. Also, what about 911? You get these morons still saying to you. Even the Bush administration has said, I mean, they make little noises. See, officially they'll say there's no connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, but then they'll slip these little remarks about how, I don't know how they do it. But officially, that everyone knows now that knows anything about reality on planet Earth, we know there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. No connection between Iraq and 9/11. However, we're on planet Earth. Bush supporters are where? Well, you've heard me say this before. They're on planet Bush, which is out past Uranus. And so 3 of 4 Bush supporters still believe in Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and Al-Qaeda ties. I mean, this is extraordinary. So when you say, what planet are these people on, that even Bush said that there's no ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, no connection between Saddam and 9/11, no weapons of mass destruction. You know how much money of our tax dollars they spent to prove that almost what everyone else in the world knew, that there were no weapons? Because Bush kept sending more and more people in there, and they spending hundreds of millions of dollars going, well, any under here? No, not there. Maybe a big pile there? No, that's just a pile of junk. Oh, there was one big pile. And that was this uranium. That wasn't in a weapons-grade stage. But that's all been looted. So when Cheney talks about we may experience a nuclear attack, and he doesn't think that John Kerry is capable of meeting that challenge, forgetting about that question, it is Cheney and the government that he's the vice president of that created the context where, who knows, where all this nuclear fissionable material has gone. Because of their attack on Iraq. That's why this happens. This is why hundreds of pounds of fissionable uranium has disappeared from Iraq. Because Bush decided to invade Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction, which he knew there weren't any. All right, but let's see. Three out of four self-described supporters of President George W. Bush still believe that pre-war Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or active programs to produce them, and that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein provided substantial support to al-Qaeda. Moreover, as many or more Bush supporters hold those beliefs today than they did several months ago. So their disconnect from reality is increasing. They're going farther and farther out into outer space. That's why planet Bush is out past Uranus. It's about as far out as you can get. Now, some of you have experience in psychology. I know there's people that are psychiatrists have written. Now, what is that psychoanalytic function when when your beliefs don't correspond to cognitive dissonance or something like that. I'm just using words. I'm not even 100% sure what they mean. So someone who's, or some of you students are in psychology now. What does this mean when the entire world knows that there's no weapons of mass destruction and Bush's supporters out there on planet Bush not only believe it, but believe it more strongly? Right. So there's a problem. There's going to be an election a week from Tuesday, and this would be so nice if this all ended, if they could just send George Bush back to Crawford, Texas, or Connecticut, or wherever he's going to decide to live, and we could get on with our lives, that everything they've done to stir up this country and this world for the past 3 years, every mistake they've made from 9/11 to taxes and the environment and workers' rights and women's rights and all that, maybe at least John Kerry would stop the hemorrhaging. I've said to people, I don't think that the world we dream in is some. The world we dream of is suddenly going to come into being. But the nightmare that Bush and his pals have created will end. They give us some breather. Give us a breather. Give us some space to start looking at our lives again and think what's possible. No more orange alerts. No more Dick Cheney's. Anyway. I wanted to say something about voting. Have you noticed that I haven't said, I want you to go out there and vote for Dick Cheney? I'm sorry. I got Cheney on the brain. That I have not, those names are all too much the same. That I have not said, I want you to go out there and vote for John Kerry. I mean, it works with my slip of the tongue as well. I haven't said to vote for anyone. And I don't even feel particularly comfortable doing that because I don't want to be responsible for the mistakes that John Kerry may or may not make. I don't want when Kerry decides, I don't want to give too fanciful a thing out there. I don't want people coming back to me and say, hey, aren't you the guy that told me to vote for John Kerry? So I'm not telling you to do that. I'm saying that we should get rid of Bush. That probably that the quickest way, if they will this time, allow the results of the vote to actually take place, is to vote Bush and Cheney out next week from Tuesday. I mean, it's too bad, though, that he wasn't driven from office by the most enormous mass movement in American history. But, so, Bush, I think, is in much more trouble than these polls, which are more generated by the media's desire to appear even-handed. It's amazing. I mean, usually they just tilt completely towards the Republican. In a lot of ways, they're tending to do that. But their reporting is, it's even. It's even Steven. It's up for grabs. It's the, what do they call those things? The battleground states. And sometimes Michigan is in one, other times it isn't, you know, so. But here are some things that are really ominous. The right-wing Detroit News. That's the Daily Paper, if you're listening across the planet or across the country. And it's always been right-wing. It's been right-wing, you know, opposed the union movement. It opposed housing integration. It supported the House. I mean, it's just terrible. It just has an unbroken record of probably 120 years of being a right-wing reactionary paper. And it supported George Bush in the 2000 election. And I'm not going to tell you that now the Detroit News has come out for John Kerry, but it says in its major editorial, for president, none of the above. So they're abstaining. Detroit News, this right-wing paper in Detroit, is abstaining from endorsing any candidate. Well, not so with lots of other papers, but even more important, a couple items here. Kid Power, Democrat John Kerry is the winner, and the rest of the country should pay attention because the vote on Nickelodeon's website has correctly chosen the president of the United States in the past four elections. Nearly 400,000 children and teens voted, and the results were released last Wednesday. Kerry received 57% of the vote, Bush 43%. And so this is Nickelodeon. And you say, well, it's not a very scientific poll. I'm not sure the regular polls are either. This as well. Majority of U.S. college students favor Democratic challenger John Kerry over President Bush, according to a Harvard University poll released on Thursday that sees a dramatic rise in campus voter turnout. Now, this is important because, the college kids usually aren't counted. They have cell phones, or they don't get phoned. It's like the 1948 Dewey and Truman election. A lot of the Truman supporters didn't have telephones. It's 48. Everybody didn't have one. Same thing here. A lot of college students, two things. They only have cell phones, and secondly, they're first-time voters. These polls almost always say, or they say they're weighted to consider every possible voter, but it's heavily weighted towards likely voters, which on the face of it, you would think, that makes sense. However, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands, I don't know if I want to say too many, go up into the millions, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of, like, slacker kids. Michael Moore's tour, 62 cities, where thousands of kids vote, thousands of students vote after or register after every appearance. So they found that the Harvard poll found out that this is Harvard's Institute of Politics. I mean, this isn't like, these friends of Kerry's or anything like that. 52% of all students want the Massachusetts senator elected president. 39% support Bush. 8% are undecided. In the hotly contested swing states, the poll shows Kerry leading Bush by 17 points among students. But, and this is, I have this on my website, and I say this is not a joke. Bush has come up with one very important endorsement. Iran. I didn't say Iraq. I said Iran. Another third of the axis of evil, along with Iraq and North Korea. The head of Iran's Security Council last Tuesday said that the re-election of President Bush was in Tehran's, that's the capital, of course, best interest, despite the administration's axis of evil label. Accusation that Iran harbors al-Qaeda terrorists and threats of sanctions over the country's nuclear ambitions. Historically, Democrats have harmed Iran more than Republicans, said Hassan Rouhani, head of the Supreme National Security Council, Iran's top security decision-making body. Rouhani said, "We haven't seen anything good from Democrats." Though Iran generally does not publicly wade into U.S. presidential politics, it has a history of preferring Republicans over Democrats and the Democrats who tend to press human rights issues. Now, how important is this? Of course, when Reagan and then Bush were presidents, they didn't care what Saddam Hussein did to the Iraqi people. All they cared was that Saddam Hussein, a secular dictator, vicious, vile, death-dealing dictator, was a U.S. ally in that region, supplied with everything from intelligence to the wherewithal of poison gases that were used on their own people, as they always say. That's all that Reagan and Bush cared about. And the Democrats at the time were saying, hey, this guy's a vicious dictator. He shouldn't get support from the American government. But that didn't matter. But you have to remember, just as Iraq quickly fell out of favor because Bush Incorporated, found another use for our erstwhile ally, Saddam Hussein, and that is punching bag to elevate the standing of the Bush administration at that time, 1990-1991. Now, this is from Wayne Madsen. I've had Wayne Madsen on as a guest. Let me see, how do they describe him? He's a Washington-based D.C. investigative journalist and columnist. He served in the National Security Council during the Reagan administration. So he was a Reaganaut, all right? And he wrote the introduction to Forbidden Truth. He's the author with John Stand of America's Nightmare, The Presidency of George Bush II. So he's obviously got some, he's got, what do they say, an agenda, unlike the people in the Bush administration. But he says, according to White House and Washington Beltway insiders, the Bush administration worried that it could lose the presidential election to Senator John F. Kennedy. Because if Karl Rove, the mastermind behind Bush, sees it as equal, he knows, never get in a fair fight. You never want to be in a fair fight. Why? Because you have 50% chance of losing if you're equally matched. So right now, there's a possibility of what they call the October surprise. But I have some thoughts about this. Anyways, Wayne Madsen says that, according to these sources, that Bush has initiated plans to launch a military strike on Iran's top Islamic leadership, its nuclear reactor at Bushehr. That's interesting. Bushehr on the Persian Gulf. And key nuclear targets throughout the country, including the main underground research site at Natanz in central Iran. Pardon me, and another in Esfahan. Targets of the planned U.S. attack reportedly include mosques in Tehran. I'm not even going to try with these names. I'm probably butchering them. Anyways, headquarters to Iran's top mullahs. Can this be? Well, first off, I think we ought to get this information out to as many Americans as we can, and I'm going to get this on my website. Because, I mean, for one thing, it almost wouldn't work. Because, say, there was some legitimacy to stopping Iraq's nuclear program. I'll talk to that in a second. But say there was. Well, you could do that on November 3rd. The only reason you would do it prior to the election would be to distort the election because people would get unfocused from the issues domestically and start thinking, oh, you know, either we're in the midst of war and we can't, another war, another extension of military power by the United States. Or that we have, once again, George W. Bush to thank for protecting us. But the only reason that Bush would have for a strike on Iran or North Korea at this time, this coming week, would be to distort the election. Because as it is, because of the suppression that's going on of African-American votes that always goes on, because of the control of these voting machines, the Democrats, by the Republicans, the Democrats have to win large. Because you can't cheat, like, tens of millions of votes. You can cheat little bits. Like, let's be honest, folks. The reason that John F. Kennedy was the president was because the Democrats in Cook County, the mayor of Chicago, cheated with a few thousand votes, which was enough. And, hey, you could cheat a few hundred in Florida, and that would be enough for Bush's father's pals in the Supreme Court to say, oh, stop the counting here. You won, kid. Right? So Democrats have to win big, and I think they have the capacity to do that. And if nothing changes, I think, between now and next Tuesday, Kerry wins. Kerry wins, probably maybe even more so than people that think he's going to win. Well, so the Republicans aren't about to let this go down. So will they launch some October surprise? Will it be an attack on Iran? And what would the American people think? They'd go, what a coincidence. Boy, just think, it could have happened on November 3rd, but instead it happened next Friday. That really surprised me. Well, your thoughts on all of this, please. Oh, yeah, here's some email. Actually, this is from Shelby. Shelby is the webmaster of radiopower.org. Radiopower.org that streams this broadcast and also rebroadcasts it on Mondays. You can go to my website and find out all that information. Shelby says, no one seems to talk about the fact that Iran is doing nothing, quote, illegal by enriching nuclear fuel for their reactors. It is only a crime to take that fuel and actually make weapons or have a weapons program, which there is no evidence that they have. The enriching of fuel is not by itself against the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so if the Nazis should attack Iran, it would be yet another war crime against humanity. Yeah, because lots of people will wind up dead. So, dear friends, as a late radio host friend of mine used to say, radio friends, dear radio friends, your thoughts, please, 313-298-WRIF. Lots more, but I'm going to take a break from talking and let you talk some. Peter Werby with you on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, and call talkyes at yahoo.com. Hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Good, although I just forgot something, but go ahead. I'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, I have a question. First, I have a comment before I ask you my question. As far as the comment you made about the U.S. attacking Iran, it makes a lot of sense that they would. I mean, with George Bush and implementing a draft, per se, and, you know, our troops are really short in Iraq and everywhere else where we're supposed to be having them, including our own country. I mean, it makes sense, if you think about it, that that's what they're going to do.
But, well, let me ask you a question. Would that be convincing? Wouldn't everybody think, wait a minute, he's going to do it on October 28th? Why couldn't he have done it on November 3rd? It's not like Iran is about to launch a strike. They don't have any capacity to launch strikes.
Right, definitely. It makes so much sense. You know, you don't even think, a lot of people, they don't even think about the stuff that's in the back of their mind, and that's what the truth is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the question I had for you was that if all these people are lying about, you know, the war in Iraq and stuff, you know, the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, when Bill Clinton was in office, I mean, people were placing phone taps on other people's phones and getting secret evidence. I mean, this guy, George Bush, he came on national TV and lied. Why isn't he being held accountable for it like, you know, Clinton was for, you know, getting a BJ in the office?
Different standards. I mean, really different standards.
My question is what power, where does he get his power that he holds over all these people that are going to, you know, that should be holding him accountable for his actions? Not just him, but, you know, people like Donald Rumsfeld and everybody else that's been lying.
The media is generally terrified of the Republicans, where they don't have much fear of the Democrats. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, that really broke the dam. Once the one person said, hey, the emperor has no clothes, and then the media finally piled on some. But they were just cowed. Most of the people in the media, look, I don't have special sources. I don't go to Washington. I knew from the available evidence, some of it even in the mainstream press, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. So the New York Times and the Washington Post and all these people that dutifully reported without one single objection these lies that the Bush administration told were doing it for what reason? I don't know. They subsequently have said, gee, we weren't vigorous enough. We weren't rigorous enough. We didn't question enough. We didn't give enough credence to the people that said there were no weapons of mass destruction. Well, but the question is, why didn't they? Why did Bush Co. get this pass? Well, that's what you're asking.
That's like a big form, I mean, of espionage. I mean, it might not be him running back and telling one person something, but he done something to hurt this country and to hurt it bad. I mean, our deficit is like so high, and it's now hurting the generation that I live in. I mean, now I'm paying money into something that I'll never see.
Well, wait a minute.
And I don't have a choice in that.
Do you plan to have children?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, your kids are going to be paying for the Bush deficit. I mean, part of when they work, and you'll be lucky if you have Social Security, and when they work, their taxes will still be going to pay down the deficit if the Bush plan is allowed to continue, where the rich get this free ride. All right, thank you very much. All right, here's what I forgot. Remember I was saying earlier that I wasn't urging people to vote for John Kerry. They wouldn't urge anyone to vote for anyone particularly. Because for one thing, voting is fairly passive. I know it can be critical at a point like this. To I mean, you can see this very easily in seeing this as a referendum on the Bush policies of war and economics and environment and the rights of so many different people and sectors of this society. And that's how I see it. In fact, Alexander Coburn has been on the show a couple of times, syndicated columnist, several times, in fact. He was writing about the march at the Republican convention on August 29th. There was 500,000 people, and as reported, there must have been about 50 Kerry signs there. 50 Kerry signs. Every other sign had to do with opposition to George W. Bush and George W. Bush's policies. All right. I'm going to ask you. In fact, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to ask you to vote for someone who's extraordinarily important. And I was going to come at it a different way because I was going to make you think I was talking about John Kerry. But I'm going to ask you to vote for someone you've never heard of. And her name is Margaret Gutshall. And it's spelled G-U-T-T-S-H-A-L-L. Margaret Gutshall. Right now she's in a coma. She was in a severe car accident last Sunday. And she is running on the Green Party. She's not a Democrat. She's not a Republican. But she's running as a Green Party candidate for the Wayne State University Board of Governors. And Margaret is an extraordinarily important person because, like so many other people like her, that they are the people that have decided not to be spectators to their lives in their own communities. They're not a big shot. They're not wealthy. They're not a famous politician. They're, like when I said her name, I'm sure only people in this audience that know of her. In fact, I may be giving some people some startling news that Margaret Gutshall was returning from an event in Kalamazoo when her car was run off the road by a semi. And she's sustained terrible physical damage. She's in a medically induced coma right now and needs all sorts of surgery. And I'm asking you, since probably most of you couldn't care less what happens with the Wayne State Board of Governors and, you know, Gaia bless the governors and Wayne State students and all that. But this would be an extraordinary act of solidarity for someone who, and you don't have to worry, it's not a Democrat, it's not a Republican, and I know a lot of you Republicans say, I don't agree with Greens either. But this is an act of solidarity with someone who's been critically injured. So think about that when you go into the polls, if you're in fact going to do that. Probably still a maximum of, probably at least 40% of the people will stay home and not vote this time. Usually it's almost 50%. Anyways, Margaret Gutshall, G-U-T-T-S-H-A-L-L, Green candidate for the Wayne State University Board of Governors. And let your thoughts, if you have prayers, let them be with Margaret and her family. There's actually another Green candidate worth voting for, Brooks Patterson. The execrable Brooks Patterson, county executive of Oakland County, is unopposed by a Democrat. So the only opposition is old pal of mine, Art Myatt, M-Y-A-T-T, Art Myatt. So if you're in Oakland County, give some consideration to Art as well. But this is just an event of, with Margaret, just such incredible tragedy. All right, let's take another call. Hi, it's WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
You ever hear of Utah Phillips?
Of course. The great Wobbly, the industrial worker of the world, storyteller and folk singer.
Yeah, his line used to be, if God had wanted you to vote, he'd have given you candidates.
There you go. Yeah, I had his stupid Pledge of Allegiance on the other week, and I'd play it right now, but I didn't bring it.
Play it again tonight, because I must have missed it.
Okay, I don't have it here. It's at home. He just pledged allegiance to the corporations. That's what he goes in. Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that rude noise, we'll say thank you for calling, and we'll be right back. Bill O'Reilly, another one of these conservative hypocrites, now accused of salacious phone sex, sexual harassment of one of his employees, and that's between him and the woman. I mean, it's worthy of public note because all of these guys are such incredible hypocrites. You ever notice what penchant for scandal these Republicans and these conservatives have? They are talking about family values. And how many sex scandals do they get involved in? There's some prominent ones with the Democrat, like old Bill. And the other thing is, the Democrats are much more open about sexuality. So we come back. Hey, we can go into the sexual thing as well, about who enjoys sex more, Republicans or Democrats. Would seem on the face of it that those stiff, uptight Republicans wouldn't be them, but we'll see what the poll says. And also, what really is frightening about Bill O'Reilly's, the charges against Bill O'Reilly from this Fox News employee. Right back.
This is the Riss Award-winning Night Call with Peter Werby. You can call in at 313-298-WRIF. Peter will return with more of your calls in just a moment.
If you're serious about advancing your business career, consider a graduate business degree from Oakland University's School of Business Administration. You'll discover a business school that offers innovative graduate degree programs, the MBA, a Master's in Accounting, a Master's of Science in Information Technology Management, and the exclusive Executive MBA in Healthcare Management. Business and industry leaders agree the Oakland University experience makes a difference. They're working with OU faculty members to create programs that successfully blend theory and practice to solve real business problems. All that translates into jobs and advancement after graduation. Don't trust your future to just any business school. Your career deserves the best. Call OU now at 248-370-3287. That's 248-370-3287. Or visit us on the web at sba.oakland.edu. Come see why Oakland University School of Business Administration is nationally recognized and accredited by the Association to Advance Collegiate Schools of Business. Think success. Think Oakland University's School of Business Administration.
Walt Michael Army Center, the ultimate recreational superstore.
It's fun to travel like a rock star. Hi, Christine Michael here for Walt Michael's RV in Belleville. We've all been to concerts and been amazed at the luxury motor coaches these rock stars travel in. Well, Walt Michaels is making it affordable for you and your family to travel like a rock star, too. And you won't even have to get on stage. Right now, during our show after the show sale, you can get unbelievable clearance savings on all 2004 motorhomes. Get more out of life and pull up to your next concert, football game, or NASCAR event in a luxurious motorhome from Walt Michaels RV in Belleville. You'll be the envy of everyone around. Come see Michigan's largest selection of luxurious motorhomes at our indoor showroom on Walt Michaels RV Mile in Belleville. You'll be amazed at how affordable it is to travel like a rock star. Give us a call at 800-697-2500. We'll be looking for you.
More Night Call with Peter Werby. Coming up next.
A message from the Red Robin Office of Enjoyment.
Hello again, it's Rudy. We're petitioning the dictionary to include the word woo. When people try the Red Robin Raging Cajun Chicken Burger, the first thing they say is woo, which means this lightly breaded chicken breast basted with a fiery cayenne pepper sauce is setting my tongue on fire. It's synonymous with ah and
Red Robin.
Yum.
Visit Red Robin Gourmet Burgers and Spirits in Dearborn or Westland.
A message from the Red Robin Office of Enjoyment.
Hi, it's Rudy, and I'm going to call Britain's royal family to tell them about our Royal Red Robin Burger.
Buckingham Palace.
Hello, old chap. I wanted to invite the royal family over for a Royal Red Robin Burger. It's got a fresh jumbo fried egg on it, just the way you like it over there.
The royal family at Red Robin? No, that's poppycock.
Okay, poppycock. Then see you here.
Red Robin.
Yum. Visit Red Robin Gourmet Burgers and Spirits in Madison Heights or Novi.
Hi, my name is Clara Shepherd. My daughter Monica suffered from asthma. I can still remember the sound of her wheezing through the night, gasping for air. I would stay up feeling helpless, wondering if the breath she would take would be her last. 1 year on a family vacation, my husband and I were smoking in the van. We thought that cracking the windows, blowing the smoke outside would be enough. Monica told us she was having trouble breathing. By the time we pulled over, Monica took her last breath as she fell into my arms. The doctor told us it was the cigarette smoke that triggered her asthma. Today, with all we know about secondhand smoke, it hurts me to remember and talk about what happened to my daughter. Secondhand smoke doesn't have to devastate your life like it did mine.
Remember, when you smoke, they smoke, whether in your house or car. Think about it. Call for more information on secondhand smoke. 1-800-537-5666. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
This is Night Call. The Riff Phone-In Talk Show. Now, here's Peter Werby.
Standing on the stage after the debates, I made it very plain. We will not have an all-volunteer army.
No!
That's Neil Young.
song, and that is the actual words of George W. Bush. Of course, he misspoke himself a few seconds later. He said, let me start again. There will not be a draft. But he said, it's one of those slips that, when you're telling lies, every time you open up your mouth, every once in a while, the truth escapes. And Country at War. Remember, I was saying a little earlier, for those of you who are listening to the beginning of the show, this article in The Independent from London, they have an article about us called Portrait of a Country on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I went to Toronto this weekend. If you like it there, why don't you stay there? You sound like a damn draft dodger anyway. I went to Toronto, and it was, I can't begin to tell you how much more at ease people in that country are here. It's palpable. You can feel it. The level of fear and rage and anxiety and nervousness that is present all among us. Look, people are having a good time. Look at Boston did. And they ever win? Did they finally win? So they got two in a row, huh? Well, is anybody in postseason play? Now, the Boston, I know. Some of you people hate when I mention anything other than denouncing Bush. And as of the Sunday after November 2nd, I'm never going to denounce George W. Bush again. Isn't that sweet? Either I'll be under arrest, right, or he'll be gone. Anyways, let's get to a couple of things that I mentioned. Another one of these conservative hypocrites, Bill O'Reilly, always family values and all this. And now he has this complaint against him, this lawsuit by a former employee, Andrea Macris. Or Macris, M-A-C-K-R-I-S. I have not heard it pronounced. Let's call it Macris, unless someone knows differently. And I have one page. You can go to thesmokinggun.com. See the whole, the whole deal, the whole complaint. And here is what's really frightening about Bill O'Reilly. Well, we know. Remember I often say about people, politics fascist, personality bully. Nobody so overtly consumes both of those publicly than O'Reilly. Most of the Bush co personalities do, except they're smart enough to publicly be real nice. Not so with O'Reilly, either on his TV shows or here. He's having these conversations, and most of which are recorded by Andrea Macris, and they're all this kind of really repressed sexuality, bone sex things, whatever. I don't really care that anyone does it, other than, like I say, it just illustrates what a hypocrite he is, assuming it's true. And from the looks of all of that's what everyone's saying. They're recorded. So here's what he says. Here's what O'Reilly says to Andrea Macris. If you cross, just listen to this language. This is the language. I'll read it. You tell me. This is from the complaint, the lawsuit against Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. If you cross Fox News Channel, it's just not me. It's Fox President Roger Ailes who will go after you, he warns. I'm the street guy out front making loud noises about the issues, but Ailes operates behind the scenes, strategizes, and makes things happen so that one day, bam, the person gets what's coming to them but never sees it coming. Bam, the person gets what's coming to them but never sees it coming. And O'Reilly hates Al Franken because Al Franken successfully makes such fun of him. He makes such incredible fun of him in his book that, what is it, Liars and Lying Liars Who Tell the Lies, whatever it is. Look at Al Franken, says Bill O'Reilly to this woman. They're not having phone sex now. He's threatening her. Look at Al Franken. One day he's going to get a knock on his door, and life as he's known it will change forever. That day will happen. Trust me. So the man who believes in these principles of American democracy, of the Constitution, of family values, of an ethical life, who was so offended by what Bill Clinton did. He sounds like a mafia hitman. He sounds like the fascist he is. He threatens Al Franken on the phone to an employee of Foxhole News. Look at Al Franken. One day he's going to get a knock on his door, and life as he's known it will change forever. That day will happen. Trust me. So this huge man physically, with all this incredible power, this multimillionaire that works for this multimillionaire who's tied in with the Bush administration, threatens you. That's pretty scary. In the meantime, American Sex Life 2004, a new primetime live sex poll conducted in conjunction with ABC News polling unit. They did this whole comprehensive survey, a detailed picture of sex attitudes and behavior in America today. And they asked, the sex poll asks, answers many provocative questions we've all wondered about but never dared to ask. How many Americans describe themselves as sexually traditional or adventurous? Actually, I have to say, I haven't had those questions myself, but now that you ask, how often are Americans having sex? What are the sex habits of cheaters? And who is cheating with their coworker and who is cheating in the workplace? Of those involved in a committed relationship, who is very satisfied with their relationship? Republicans say 87%, Democrats 76%. Who is very satisfied with their sex life? Republicans 56%, Democrats only 47%. Who has worn something sexy to enhance their sex life? Republicans 72%, Democrats 62%. Now, I don't even know. I mean, I was thinking, I'm not going there with me. You know who I am. You can say what you want. Asked whether they had ever faked an orgasm. More Democrats, 33%, than Republicans, 26%, said they had. Now, there's a couple of things working here. First off, I just don't believe this. Because people lie always to pollsters about, and they say, well, we take that into account. But how do you take it into account? About sex, income, and religion. Sex, income, and religion. People lie repeatedly about it. And there is, by the repressive activity of Republicans and conservatives, that sort of brings us all into question. Let me see. It says, among the factors that impact the survey results is that more men identify themselves as Republicans, and men are more likely to say they are sexually satisfied and enjoy sex a great deal. Also, Democrats are more likely to be women, and the poll results show that women are more likely to fake orgasms. Yeah, guys usually do not fake orgasms, right? So this is kind of off the wall. But your thoughts. This, we have only the poll results here. More Republicans satisfied with sex lives than Democrats. Aren't they always getting caught, like these preachers, with prostitutes and everything like this? I don't even know what to make of that. But this is out of this. I had this in this pile with the stuff about church attendance as well. And, you know, I've lost this. Here it is. I saw this as a letter in my favorite atheist publication, Free Thought Today, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And you can go to ffrf.org. And there is a letter. Hopefully it's right here in front of me. No, of course not. It's somewhere in the back. I wanted to... Richard Mulliken, Ph.D., New York. So he's Dr. Mulliken. And he says, I'm confident that I can demonstrate that actual church attendance in the United States involves at most 7% of the population. You know, they're always saying this is the most religious country in the world. Well, that's what these conservatives and Republicans say. When they're not having sex, that they're enjoying more than Democrats, they're in church. Now, Dr. Mulliken says, I believe that the grossly inflated figures reported by all the major polls are artifacts. That is, such data becomes received wisdom. I'm a trained social scientist, now retired. I believe I can get irrefutable demographic data to back my claim with a set of volunteers. Now, what he's talking about, I emailed him. And if you're listening, Dick Mulliken, hello. He says, thanks for your interest. At present, I have only a small sample involving four rural communities here in Delaware County, New York. They yield a maximum attendance of 8% of the population, less than one-third of what even responsible surveys have found. In other words, they'll say there's like a third. And he says, I can send you the details of the pilot. I thought I had another email for him as well. So, I mean, what people like Dr. Mulliken do is they get these polls and they say, you know, like 80% of people say they go to church every Sunday. Then they take, well, there's 10,000 people saying that, and the church will hold 400. So if everybody in Delaware County, I'm not saying these are his figures, but just for instance, tried to get in the churches there, there'd be thousands and thousands of people standing outside. So it's just more hypocrisy on people that are sanctimonious, self-righteous hypocrites. Aren't they? And that's why they're always trying to shove everything down our throats. Hey, remember, wasn't I saying that last week? As far as we're concerned, the liberal, tolerant, generous people, the open-hearted people, the people that mind their own business, we say, if you don't want to have an abortion, don't have one. No one's forcing you to have an abortion. If you want to marry somebody of the opposite sex, go ahead. If you don't want to smoke marijuana, don't. And 101 other things. But their deal is that they're going to take their ideas or their religious beliefs and use the police, which is the armed force of the political state, to enforce their views of the world down upon the rest of us. This is why one of the 1,500 reasons that George W. Bush has got to go. Because what they're preparing for us is this a theocracy, a religious state. Now, everywhere where religion has dominated the political state or been an equal partner, it's been a terrible government and terrible for the most of the citizens. You've probably heard me say, one nation under God, Iran, Afghanistan under the Taliban. Why our first ancestors came over here from England to escape the political state that dictated the nature of religion. They were free thinkers in that regard. Now, there are, it's kind of strange, in France and in Italy, there's been these cases of women who have been, in the case of an adult woman who was actually fined for wearing a veil, a Muslim veil over her face in Italy, and these Muslim girls in France that were told they couldn't wear these scarves, and these Sikh, people who wear turbans, told they couldn't wear their turbans. Also, you cannot have large crosses, because the French state, long time ago, realized that the more that religious life is intertwined with political life, it's poisonous to both. Well, tell me what you think. If you're waiting for what we've talked about earlier, you can continue with that as well. 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, this is Mark from Romeo.
Hi, Mark.
I'm just calling. You know, I think it's tomorrow. I read in the paper today in the Macomb Daily that Kerry is coming to, you know, Macomb Community College.
You are absolutely right.
And I think that's a load because I still have classes. And it's going to be create such a hassle for me that he's so inconsiderate on when he comes. He could have come over the weekend. He could have come any other time. But no, he's got to come right in the middle of, like, you know, thousands of people having class.
Wait a minute, Mark. Maybe we can call him. Mark's got class. No, here, listen. Every time a political candidate comes, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, that's all. Everything is screwed up. They always seem to come at rush hour. They shut down everything. Everyone's life is disrupted. But you know, I think you can live through it.
And can I make one more point?
Would you have cared if it was Bush?
No.
Okay.
No, it would peeve me off either way.
All right.
And you always talk about how the Republicans and the censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't Tipper Gore, head of the PMRC, the people who put the parental advisory stickers on all our CDs?
Yeah, yeah. You know, listen, there's nothing that's absolute. And, not only was I extraordinarily critical of her, that I have an interview that's online with Frank Zappa, the late Frank Zappa, that talks about that, and he just rips her a new one.
Okay.
By the way, during the 1990s, I was a constant critic of Clinton and Gore and look forward to being a constant critic of President Kerry.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. Hey, I thought he was calling up for something else because, who sent this to me? Oh, I don't have it. Anyways, John Kerry will be at the Macomb County College Fieldhouse at 14500 East 12 Mile Road in Warren tomorrow. And you can go to johnkerry.com/events, johnkerry.com/events. And they want you to register online. And it says Fresh Start for America Rally with John Kerry, Monday, October 25th. Doors open at 4 p.m. Macomb Community College Fieldhouse, 14500 East 12 Mile Road, Warren, Michigan. Parking is available. Please limit personal items, no signs or bags. Now, why wouldn't I announce a George Bush rally as well? Well, because of the manner in which these Bush rallies are carried out. If you're a Republican, you can go to that Kerry rally. And every time John Kerry says, we're going to get a new America, and everyone is clapping. You can go, boo, you suck, all right? And people probably look at you and what have you. Not so at a George Bush rally or a Dick Cheney rally. You are tackled by police. You're smashed to the ground if you manage to get in there at all. That's why I would never announce this. You have to have you have to pass an ideological test. These are rallies for the Republicans of the party, faithful only. They're not to speak to people. They're to it's like a fascist rally. And they have goon squads. In fact, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, just yesterday, they turned away somebody who was identified as a Democratic supporter. No signs, no yelling, no snarky T-shirts, just a known Democrat. And it says the spotters and eventually police asked the Democratic supporter to remove a jacket, a sweater, and some other articles of clothing in what was described as basically a police search. Even worse, a U.S. Army soldier who's bound for Iraq in 2 weeks, a registered Republican no less, was barred from the rally for apparently associating with the Democratic sympathizer. So that's why you're never going to hear me. I wouldn't tell you the truth, wouldn't go to a Kerry rally. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't or anything like that. That doesn't hold great interest to me. But they're rallies of certainly of different types. All right, more. Anybody say they want to talk about that? Do Republicans, no one yet has addressed the question, do Republicans enjoy sex more than Democrats, according to this poll? All right, we'll go on with your calls when we come back.
WRIF.com. At First Horizon Home Loans, we know you go through a lot when you buy a home, and it can get a little nerve-wracking. From negotiating the price to inspections, even making sure repairs are made. But there's at least one thing that's a little less stressful. Getting your loan from First Horizon. We draw on the strength of a nationwide network of loan officers who will guide you every step of the way. First Horizon has all kinds of programs for all kinds of buyers. We'll help you select the one that best fits your needs so you can take care of other things, like choosing new furniture, designing a deck or patio. Well, you get the idea. We'll make it easy and give you the options you need. First Horizon Home Loans. Get home with less stress.
Call Mike Jenkins at First Horizon Home Loans today at 877-505-8600, extension 222, and get home with less stress. That's 877-505-8600, extension 222. Loan subject to credit approval, equal housing lender. Getting ready to move into your new home? Got a business to relocate? Need help moving and packing delicate or fragile stuff? For your moving needs, don't bother calling the middleman when you can go straight to the boss. The professionals at Boss Moving and Service. Boss Moving and Service has been family owned and operated for over 20 years. They specialize in local moving with a fleet of 9 trucks. They carry a full line of packing materials. They're licensed by the state and fully insured. Boss is also your home and business relocation specialist. Whether it's one item, a piano, or organ, maybe a delicate antique or an entire truckload. Whatever you need to make your move go smoother, Boss Moving and Service has you covered. Compare Boss Moving's low prices to the other guys, and you'll learn what others in Metro Detroit have known for years. Don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss. Call the professionals at Boss Moving and Service toll-free at 800-706-6644. Call today for a free in-home estimate at 800-706-6644. Remember, don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How
are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Coach Nick Saban after his loss to Auburn over the weekend, and we had to get his thoughts on his replacement, John L. Smith.
I think he's doing a fine job, but first of all, three words, collagen rebuilding serum. if he's leading the Big Ten in anything, it's dead epidermal cells. I don't think 10 minutes in a tanning bed would kill the guy either.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't like to pass advice along. I let the guy make his own mistakes.
Well, you know, he's pretty pasty looking, actually. You're right.
I think that's why he left Louisville. They used the gray for the coaching shirts, and he looks so washed out and ashy. I think a guy complected like that, at some point, has got to coach a team that has primary colors.
Well, Nick, not to bring this whole thing down, but what went wrong against Auburn?
Well, you mix together an unfamiliar 1875 Revlon with a Bumble and Bumble Stylers, throwing some unforeseen humidity, and that's what you get.
That's not like you to blame defeat on weather conditions, though.
I'm not talking about the game. I'm talking about that sweat-soaked, wind-blown mess on the top of my head.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
101.1.
Riff. When it's 5 o'clock, it's time to rock with the Riff.
Weekday afternoons at 5, right here on 101 WRIF.
Your ride home rocks with Big Daddy Arthur P. Playing your Riff Rockin' Request. Call in your Riff Rockin' Request to the Grand Poobah at 313-298-WRIF.
Email them to arthurp@wrif.com.
Hell, you can even fax them in before you ditch the office at 248-398-6219. Call for the tunes that you want to hear. Win yourself some killer Riff swag and let the ride home rock with the Riff's own Big Daddy Arthur Penalo.
Riff is the only station letting you pick your favorites and program the station three times a day at noon, 5, and 9.
It's your all-request Riff Rock and Ride Home with Big Daddy Arthur P.
On the Mother City's one and only, home of rock and roll.
101 WRIF.
Riff.
Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the Morning.
We talk with Maury Povich.
Drew and Mike, you are not the father.
Oh, thank God.
That's great. We're going to use that time and time again in our life.
What is the longest and the most attempt?
Imagine there's no country.
Now, if you heard the earlier one where we had the recording of him saying there will not be an all-volunteer army. Well, and then he kind of cleaned it up, did he, though? Let's see. Here someone writes in, almost sounds like they're shouting. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Don't tell the listeners Kerry will win. You want them to decide to skip going to the polls? Also, remember to vote no on the bigoted same-sex union proposal. Oh, yeah, vote no on Prop 2, which would put into the Constitution of Michigan, would forbid gay marriage. Yeah, there's a law called the Defense of Marriage Act. So it's against the law to marry somebody of the same sex. But this is what I mean. This is these religious nuts are trying to shove down their view of love and marriage. Goes together like a horse and carriage. That's some old song from like the 30s or something like that. There's Separation of Church and State Day, Wednesday, October 22nd. All right, let's go back and revisit some of the issues. What were we talking about that upset our letter writer there, our email writer? The fact that I said that it appears that Kerry at this point will probably win. But you have to remember that I said that there's all this thought now that there's going to be an attack on Iran next week. And I said that if there was some reason, I don't think there is, but if there was some reason to attack Iran, November 3rd would do. November 3rd would do. The only reason that there would be any military attack in the next week would be attempt to distort the electoral process. The kids on Nickelodeon have picked Kerry. College students in swing states as high as 17% more voters for Kerry. That's why I said that. Although Bush has received the official endorsement from Iran, even though he's given him a hard time. They say that they don't like the Democrats very well. But I was concerned. No one's commented on this, headline from the Independent that's a newspaper in England. Portrait of a country on the verge of a nervous breakdown. They say we're losing it. This is from somebody in Sterling Heights, I don't even use their first name. He says, I'm in the National Guard and just received word we have a deployment coming up, so most likely it will be Iraq. I have come to the conclusion that I cannot support the so-called effort over there and am preparing to file for conscientious objection. I know this is a serious path, but I don't see what else I can do. I also know I could probably take a public stand against the war if I go this route. And I'm not a religious person, and I can't stand the evangelical BS in the White House, but this is a time I am praying that this tyrant is thrown out of power come November 2nd. There's a group now, in fact, next week I'll have an interview with him, Mike Hoffman, the founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Remember, like, Kerry was in Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Mike Hoffman has now formed Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org. IVAW.org. I guess, I don't know. I guess he can run for president. Huh? Also, Terry writes in, as much as I hate to admit it, being the longtime Republican that I am, you've helped me to see what is going on. Because of you and your show, I've researched things much deeper than I normally would have. And although I still remain a Republican on most issues, I'm voting for Kerry. Now, what's the most important sentence in there? Not I am voting for Kerry. Not that I am voting for Kerry. That's what Terry just wrote. The most important sentence in there, I have researched things much deeper than I normally would have. He's thinking for himself. That's what is important. All right. Let's go to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. This is Ralph in Newport.
Hi, Ralph.
I was calling to you about, you were talking about religion and politics.
Sure.
Quite frankly, it's hard to separate religion from politics. Everybody, you know, they try and do it, and they say they do it, but, I mean, come on. And both the presidential debates, on everyone I've seen, the debates, both of them came out and telling you, you know, what religion they are. And it's almost impossible to separate it.
Well, it is in this country. They don't do it in other democracies. No one mentions their religion.
It's just a joke to me how they how we try so hard to say that we do separate it when we don't, and it's so clear to everybody that we don't.
Yeah, I know. It's that's why I can't even watch those debates. I mean, essentially, it's two candidates posturing for this sort of undecided vote, and they hope that, well, maybe they can, you know, like one half of 1% will say, oh, he's as religious. Yeah, it is pretty disgusting.
Yeah, it's very disgusting. I mean, everything we do is based on our religion, every decision we make. And, you know, even Bush was saying how he prays every day to God, and, you know, and that's what brought up his religion and about the war and everything.
Well, you know, Ronald Reagan's son at the Democratic Convention said, he said, my father was religious, but he didn't trust politicians that wore their religion on their sleeves. I know a lot of very liberal religious people of all faiths, and they rarely ever mention it to me, although it's the motivating force in their life. But they don't ever say, well, Jesus told me, or God. I mean, this is what's so frightening about Bush, that he actually says that that God is acting through him, or he prays. And the idea is, like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, he's getting messages. Well, they used to lock people up that got messages like that. Now, the president. It's frightening. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Hi, it's WRIF, and you're on the air. We got some open lines for you as well. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. This is Chris from Brownstown.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, I had to talk to you about Proposal 2.
Okay.
You just mentioned it a few minutes ago, and I think it goes so much deeper than gay marriage, because I'm telling everybody now, I work at Metro Airport, okay, and I work at the gift shops, and I run into a lot of people throughout the day. And I've discovered that most people, in fact, almost everyone, has no clue what either of these proposals are about.
Hmm.
And...
Right, I mean either one or two?
You're right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. But I know I don't have a lot of time here, so I'm just going to stick with Proposal 2. This is just like the most... one of the most evil acts this country has ever seen, and that's saying a lot. It goes beyond gay marriage, and I got to tell everybody that Proposal 2 will not ban gay marriage, because there are already at least three laws in Michigan banning gay marriage. You can't make it more banned.
Well, yeah, that's right. There's the Defense of Marriage Act, the state act. So this is absolutely unnecessary. This was put forth by Republicans and evangelicals as a way to encourage more of their faithful to come out and vote for Bush. But also, I mean, it'll disgrace us eventually, because most places where this has been on the ballot, it's passed, because just like so many other instances in American history, when people are asking for rights, the people that are in the majority say, oh, wait a minute, this is different. I don't know what will happen. But we'll be like those states that had laws against blacks marrying whites and stuff like that. So this is really going to disgrace us if this gets put in the foundation document of our state.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to mention. So many years ago, blacks weren't allowed to get married. And I saw in the paper, and I've seen all over the place, that these black religious people are all, you know, discriminating and prejudiced against these gays. And when they were fighting against the exact same things themselves, I mean, they should be ashamed. Their parents and their grandparents would beat them. I know the grandparents told them horror stories about all the protests.
Sure.
And Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and fighting the same thing that they're putting out.
Well, I'll tell you, for one thing, it's hard to make a generalization. Some there's many, and you see, it six of one, half a dozen of the other. You'll find some African American churches that are socially very conservatives, that are against abortion, they're against homosexuality, and there's other churches that are much, much more liberal. But no, it seems extraordinarily inconsistent, but not unknown in the way that human beings act. You don't like it when you're being discriminated against, however, you're a lot less sympathetic to people that you would think it would be viewed similarly. I agree. All right, Chris, thank you very much. I appreciate your call very much. Ever wonder where our money goes? We know it goes. We look at our paychecks and it's gone, and we don't have a wonderful health system, and our schools are pretty crappy and lots of other stuff like that. So we know, well, a couple of things here. There's what's the name of this group? Publicaccuracy.org. There, Antonia, how do you say this name now? Hujas, has a op-ed piece called "Nice Little War to Fill the Coffers." Appeared in the Los Angeles Times. Is Halliburton far and away the largest recipient of Iraq reconstruction dollars, with about $18 billion in contract, has seen revenues increase, blah, 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 blah. Next in line is Bechtel Group of San Francisco. They were very instrumental. They were a group that agitated for the war because they knew the Carlyle Group, which is Bush's father's company, would destroy Iraq and then they'd get to rebuild it. This is the racket that Bush Co. is. And talks about everything that was generated. All right, so there's all this money is being made. This is all our tax dollars. Whenever you hear billions going to Iraq, it's really going to U.S. corporations. In fact, they have it set up under these rules that were enforced upon them by the dictator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, the Republican appointed, what was he, the viceroy of Iraq, that all of this money could come back to the United States, because under Saddam Hussein's laws, that couldn't happen. Anyways, we find another little piece here. Corporate chiefs enjoyed bumper year in 2003. Well, how about that? American chief executives enjoyed a lucrative year in 2003, according to the survey by the Conference Board. Compensation, salary, bonuses, and long-term payments combined advanced in every industry. By the way, the average middle-class wage dropped in this period. Maybe you made a little more money. So you're saying, what the hell? I made, I got $10,000 raise. Well, that's not the average. The average middle-class wage dropped. And they've enjoyed, corporate chiefs in the booming construction industry came off best, with a median or middle-of-the-range leader enjoying a 20% jump in compensation to almost $3 million. Now, put those together. What do you see here? Here is Halliburton, by far and away the largest recipient of Iraq construction dollars, and Bechtel in second place, and then, hey, they're getting all this money. So, essentially, you and I, whether you're not going to vote, whether you're going to be in the 40%, whether you're a Republican and hate John Kerry and support the war completely, you have just given the CEO of Halliburton, no, it's no longer Dick Cheney, even though he still gets money from the company, you have just given the head of Halliburton a $3 million raise. And so have I. So we're no longer, like, different. We don't have different views of the world, ideologies, opinions, morals, ethics, what have you. We're just suckers that are being fleeced by Bush Co., which then hands the money over to their pals in these construction industries. And what I always say, two ways you can look at this. It's either what I've just said is a lie, just made this all up, that Halliburton and Bechtel really aren't recipients of all this money, so all of this reporting, factual reporting, has been made up by me or some leftist, or that the corporate chiefs really didn't get a $3 million raise, and we know it's all coming from tax dollars, all right? Or it's okay. then you're the biggest sucker that's walking on the plane. It's all right. I don't mind if they get more money. They're helping our country. After the other company Bush is connected to destroyed Iraq, then his other pals rebuild it, and we pay for both. In the meantime, the average middle class wage is dropping. I just don't even know what to say. And here in probably the most understated headline of the year in the New York Times, Iraq susceptible to corruption, according to a survey. Iraq is susceptible to corruption. Iraq, which was ranked among the world's most corrupt nations in a survey released yesterday, is likely to see rampant corruption in its oil industry and reconstruction efforts unless the United States, Britain, and other powerful nations take aggressive steps to combat bribery and theft of public money. The public money all comes from us, dear friends. That's why there's 35 kids in the class. That's why there's huge potholes. That's why we don't have enough security at our ports. All of this. Now, what steps are Britain, the U.S., and other powerful nations going to take? That put these all together, connect the dots. Rampant corruption in Iraq's oil industry and reconstruction efforts. Halliburton and Bechtel making a fortune. And corporate chiefs, pardon me, enjoying bumper year in 2003. A total racket. A total racket. This is not a government, dear friends. This is a racket posing as a government. It's not even Bush Co. It's not even Bush Incorporated. It is a racket of the mafia type. It is a crime syndicate. All right, here. Okay, you're going, well, can you prove that? How about this? New York Times business section. Who the hell reads this except for these guys whose salaries we're paying at $3 million additional? Safeguarding Columbia's oils. Safeguarding Columbia's oil. U.S. advisors and equipment help government fend off rebels. Well, isn't that nice of us? Isn't that a sweet little gift that we're giving them? Puerto Vega, Colombia. In the biggest, most ambitious army offensive in Colombia's 40-year rebel war, 18,000 counterinsurgency troops have since January fanned out across four isolated southern states, a lawless swath that for years has functioned as a de facto republic for Marxist rebels. There's a shot of them all, and they're all wearing American uniforms. They all have American guns. So you and I paid for it. Again, doesn't matter what our politics are. We can call each other on the phone like we are now, or we can meet in a bar and scream, Bush, Gary, you know, like that. In the meantime, our tax dollars, regardless of our politics, are going to these companies. The companies, yeah. Aided by American helicopters, planning and surveillance, Colombian forces have the stated goal of penetrating the historic heart of Colombia's largest rebel group. According to James Hill, the general and commander of the United States forces in Latin America, to strike a decisive blow to narco-terrorists. Well, wait a minute. That's not so bad. We don't want narco-terrorists around, whatever the hell they are. But here is the real deal. But the Washington backed offensive has another motive. Oil and military authorities say one that Colombia and American officials only gingerly discuss. Well, no wonder. And that is to make potentially oil-rich regions safe for explorations by private companies and the government-run oil company. So you and I aren't just paying, what is it now, $2 at the pump? We're saying, well, it's still less than Italy. Our tax dollars are going to fund our armed forces and our military equipment, like helicopters and what have you, in order to allow, like, Occidental Petroleum to safely pump oil out of Colombia. So that $2 a gallon has a lot of hidden costs in there. Because we're paying taxes to support this effort of 18,000 counterinsurgency troops. So it's all a racket, friends. We don't have a government. We have a corrupt mafia running things. Again? Line 4 once again? Okay. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
What I wanted to say is that I don't know if they'll bomb Iran next week, but what I do think is going on, and I'm going to explain to you, for instance, is they're going to start making people think the terrorists are going to try to sabotage our elections.
Right.
Bush did an interview with Hannity and Combs. It's going to air tomorrow night, but they released some of his comments already from it. And one of the things he was asked if he thought that the terrorists would try to disrupt our elections, he says, well, we have nothing specific. It is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of that is to keep people from coming to the polls, because Republicans always benefit from a lower turnout.
Sure.
The higher the turnout is, the better the Democrat, the candidate usually does. But this man has shamelessly exploited in these commercials 9/11 and the terrorists. That's the only thing he's running on is if you don't vote for me, the terrorists are going to get you.
Well, what else would he run on? All of his accomplishments that have made America better, which are what? Way underfunded, leave no child behind, a tax break that has sunk us into debtor status and given off all this money to the ultra wealthy. What else is there? There are no accomplishments whatsoever.
Well, you know what gets me, Peter, though, is I work with guys who are basically are sympathetic to the Democrats because they're working shifts, but they're also NRA members, and they are scared to death that John Kerry is going to take their gun away from them.
Why?
But I don't know why.
No, that's the question, because Kerry, of course, is let's go kill some geese. You know?
Yeah.
That's why he's doing it. Like, the Republicans are making fun of him and all that. He's trying to communicate to people like the guys that you're talking about is, hey, look, I like to shoot guns. I kill things. I owned, one time you say they owned an AK-47 or some Chinese assault weapon or something like that. No, that's absolutely preposterous. There is no intention of the Democrats to go any farther with legislation than already exists. And it's interesting, the NRA, they wanted the ban on assault weapons not renewed. And one of the reasons they said it was only cosmetic, which to a large extent it was. It didn't take anyone's gun away. So one could ask, if it was only cosmetic and didn't really do anything, why did they oppose it?
And Bush played it both ways on that. You know, he said that he would like to see the ban extended, but then he did nothing as far as trying to persuade the Congress to renew the ban. But Peter, it amazes me, though. I meet these people who don't make a lot of money, who aren't union auto workers, guys making 10, 11, 12 bucks an hour. They will vote against their own economic interests because they think that John Kerry is going to take their gun away from them.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I think, one, it's either just pure stupidity, it also could be that they don't think that either politician is going to deliver, but at least they can keep their guns.
Yeah. Well, I mean, show me, with all these gun laws that have been passed, I've yet to find a case of one honest, law-abiding citizen that has ever had a federal person knock at their door and take their gun away. It just has never happened, Peter. And the NRA is the closest thing, in my opinion, to a fascist organization that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they'll get sent packing along with Bush. Thank you very much.
All right.
Appreciate your call. Speaking of fascists, I can't even make any sense of this. I was saying that Bill O'Reilly was a fascist. So who is this person? What's his name here? Hey, fascist. So this is just a name. I mean, this is somebody that doesn't know what fascism is about. Fascism is another, in some ways, authoritarian and dictatorial and also corporatist. In other words, that Hitler and Mussolini ruled for the corporations. I had the misfortune of my radio landing on your propaganda fest tonight. As sometimes happens, I get sucked in listening just to see how far you will go with lies and misinformation before someone calls you on it. It seems that you are still harping on the weapons of mass destruction thing. And the poor, uninformed, lemming-like callers I've heard were sig-heiling your ever... Well, see, there's nothing here. This is insubstantive. There's no substance to it. It doesn't say... I'm still harping on it. I wonder if he would say that to the families of the 1,100... American soldiers that have been killed. I wonder if he would say that to them. I wonder if he'd say that to the 8,000 vets that have been wounded so horrifically. There's an article in ABC News. Injured Iraq vets come home to poverty. Injured soldier returning from Iraq struggle. Injured soldiers returning from Iraq struggle for medical benefits and survival, financial survival. And Army Specialist Tyson Johnson III of Mobile, Alabama, who lost a kidney in a mortar attack last year in Iraq, was still recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center when he received notice from the Pentagon's own collection agency that he owed more than $2,700 because he could not fulfill his full 36-month tour of duty. And this goes on to say, stories like Tyson Johnson's are not unique. Many of the severely wounded soldiers returning from Iraq face the prospect of poverty and what they describe as official indifference and incompetence. So when I harp on weapons of mass destruction, it's because my heart is breaking for the families of the dead American soldiers and the families and the men themselves that have been wounded and the tens of thousands of Iraqis that have died because of Bush's lies. Now, if that is, what was his word, harping. Well, I mean, I guess he wishes that we would just play it like a football game. Why would I keep saying that? Why don't we just root for the home team? Well, the home team, as soon as the election occurs, whether Bush wins or loses, the home team is going to launch these assaults probably on 20 Iraqi cities and suffer hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of more losses and thousands of more wounded Americans and thousands of more Iraqi civilians, all to establish this Imperial Oil outpost. Anyways, back to this article. Perhaps a sign of the grim outlook facing many of these wounded soldiers, Staff Sergeant Peter Damon, a National Guardsman from Brockton, Massachusetts, said he is grateful. This is how bad Bush treats veterans. He's grateful for being a double amputee. He said, well, in a way, I'm kind of lucky losing both arms because I've been told I'll probably get 100% disability. Staff Sergeant Larry Gill, a National Guardsman from Alabama, wondered whether his 20 dutiful years of military service have been adequately rewarded. He injured his leg when on patrol during a protest outside a mosque in Baghdad. A protester threw a hand grenade, which left his left leg useless. It's not fair, and I'm not complaining. I'm not whining about it. You know, I just don't think people really understand what we're being faced with. So sorry if I harp on it, pal. I'm Peter Werby, 313-298-WRIF, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Also, please, whatever your name is, Beeman or Benman or something like that, go to your dictionary, do a little reading, find out what a fascist is. All right, then you won't sound so foolish in public. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is your loyal listener from Romulus, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
I just had a couple of quick points to make in terms of the gay marriage issue that you were talking about a few minutes ago. I'm not sure if you remember Barry Goldwater, conservative.
Famous election 40 years ago this year.
Right. He said it was kind of funny because when the issue came up, I don't know in relation to what, back in Arizona, the Republicans approached him because he was the icon of the conservative movement, whatever, and they wanted to ask him his opinion on gays serving in the military. And I'm not sure if you remember what his answer was, because it shocked them, and they were so bent out of shape about it, they were really mad. Because he said, well, if somebody's volunteering to go and stand on the wall and protect this country, I don't care what their sexual orientation is. I'm happy that there's one more person willing to stand up and fight for my freedom and my safety.
Well, Barry Goldwater was out of the Libertarian League that the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party that actually believed that government should get off of people's back. These current people are conservative, proto-fascists, and they think the government should control things like their sexuality and their intoxication and their reproductive rights and on and on and on and on.
Sure, and It's amazing because if you really look at the meaning of the word conservative, it would mean that they wouldn't want interference from anybody. So this whole issue is just like, I don't know what to think about this, because this is just, you know, it's one of the typical hypocritical tirades against some group or some segment by the Republicans.
Sure, and we don't want to just be indignant. I mean, these people intend to rule our lives. They want to encroach more and more on our personal liberties, and they want us to more and more fund their religious institutions. And they want to alter the nature of the American government. I thought, like, Reagan was hideous. I thought most presidents have been pretty bad. Reagan was pretty hideous, for instance. But what we're talking about now with Bushko is the alteration, the fundamental alteration of what this country is all about. And George Bush is probably the most dangerous man that has ever ascended to the American presidency. And, of course, he was only able to ascend by corruption. He was he only took the office by theft.
Sure, and some of the statements that are coming out from some of the Republican senators are just really frightening. They had one from in the New York Times, I think about 3 to 4 weeks ago, from the senator from Kansas, Brownback.
Sure.
And he said that their goal was to completely erode the separation of church and state. And my last question to you was, if you'd watched the last or heard the last debate between President Bush and Senator Kerry, when President Bush was asked whether he thought that homosexuality was a choice or not, and his answer, which was that he didn't know. What do you think about it? I thought it was kind of dishonest.
And which, who said they didn't know?
Bush.
Bush. No, I believe him. He does not know. He knows little. And that's, and he fills his emptiness with this religiosity. And has the qualities of a chicken, stupid and mean. Well, all right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. All right, let's take one more call before our break. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, it's Jeff from Detroit Rock City.
Jeff from Detroit Rock City. Right, you're getting, is it next week you're going to have the, no, it's the week after.
2 weeks from now.
2 weeks.
November 6th is the final liberal palooza.
Yeah, we're actually kind of slurring over these words. It's Jeff from Rock City. It's liberal palooza. This is events that occur at Jeff's music shop on Van Dyke and Warren, just south of, or just north of 9 Mile, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I had the privilege of speaking at one of them. So what do you think? Is it going to be a funeral or is it going to be a celebration?
Well, I'm planning on a celebration, but I always get ready for the other one. I've been looking into how to move to Canada, if that's the case.
Yeah, well...
That's the idea. I mean, Windsor's looking much nicer than another 4 years of Bush. But you may not want to say it, but I can say it. I want everybody to vote for John Kerry.
Okay.
I'm going to see him tomorrow, and I can't wait to see him. I saw Edwards a couple weeks ago. He was fantastic. And just getting everybody motivated to change this country for the better.
Yeah, people can get your T-shirts, too. We can't say the word on radio, but huge letters, F. Bush, right?
Yeah, I wore that in such a spot. They wouldn't let me up front to see John Kerry, or John Edwards, but they let me stand in such a spot to where him and the mayor and the governor all got a good look at it.
What did they say? Anything or any?
I could see him up on the stage just cracking up.
Well, maybe.
And I sold a few of them after the show.
Maybe you can make it onto one of these right-wing websites. See? That's what kind of person supports John Kerry. How can people get those T-shirts?
Let's go to DetroitRockCity.org.
Mm-hmm.
Or come by the store. I'm pretty much sold out of those dirty ones, though.
Oh, the dirty ones, mean with the F word on it.
Yeah, they pretty sold pretty quick last week.
Flew out the door. All right. Well, they made.
What I wanted to talk to you about tonight was you were talking about gas prices earlier.
Yeah, gasoline prices, $2 plus all these hidden costs. Think about this. I know the war against Iraq that has now cost over $100 billion, that is not figured into how much we're paying per gallon. But this is what's flown out of our pockets into the pockets of Bush's rich supporters, and we don't figure that into the $2 a gallon.
What's not even figured in that most people don't realize is there's subsidy costs involved with that, too.
Sure.
According to Bobby Kennedy's son, Bobby Kennedy Jr., on an interview with him on Hardball, he says that the actual price of a gallon of gas is up close to around $6. But
he pays so much
in subsidies to the oil companies to keep the price low, keep us subdued so that we don't get irate at Detroit.
Well, all these right-wingers, conservatives, always used to call this show and talk about these welfare mothers. But what we really ought to be concerned about are these welfare, I can't say the same effort.
Welfare
mother efforts in these corporations. Right. That's who's stealing our money.
The corporations are worth millions, and we're still giving them millions upon millions extra just because of We want to.
And these poor saps, even back then, when they would talk to me about, oh, these welfare people, they're stealing all of my tax dollars. And I'd say, what about the corporate welfare? And they go, huh? And I'd explain the whole deal and how little welfare amounted to for individuals, and that the majority of people on welfare were children and women without men in the house that were supporting the children and disabled, and there were virtually no able-bodied men. And they go, well, I still don't like my taxes. And I'd say, yeah, but your tax dollars are going to welfare for corporations. There'd be silence. I said, do you approve of that? Well, I don't like that either.
I'd like to see the actual figures, because I would estimate that if you just cut off all the corporate subsidies in 1 year, you could probably end poverty as we know it, if you redistribute that wealth.
Oh, sure, sure. And, you know, you could still have wealthy people and what have you, except you wouldn't have these obscene variations of wealth and poverty. All right. Hey, Jeff, thank you so much. Liberal Palooza, you can go to DetroitRockCity.org. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com. Go to the Detroit calendar over on the left side, and you can hook into Jeff's site as well. Go by his store, see if they got any of those F. Bush shirts. All right. Let's make sure it's a celebration, Jeff. Thanks for joining us. Let's take a break.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more of your calls right after this.
Okay, so my friend Jerry has this Harley that he takes really, 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 really good care of. Almost too good care, if you know what I mean.
Oh, love you. Yes, I do.
I'm going to rub your tag. Yes, I am, you cutie. Yeah. So Jerry takes his bike into Motown Harley-Davidson for winter storage because he can't store it in his own bed. And believe me, he's tried.
Oh, no, Shrooby, it's getting cold. We're taking you to Motown Harley-Davidson for winter storage. Winter vacation.
So Jerry takes his motorcycle to Motown Harley-Davidson in Taylor, where it's only $279.95 for deluxe treatment and winter storage, and his bike will be ready for him in the spring.
Hello, Honey Bunch. It's time to take you home from your long winter's nap. No, come on, sweetie. I know you had a good time, but it's time to go.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley-Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks dig a guy on a real motorcycle.
Buy or sell your bike at Motown!
Okay.
Attention Ford employees. In the event of a Ford plant closing, WRIF will be there with up-to-the-minute information. This message is brought to you by WRIF and the Ford Motor Company.
Stick around. More Night Call with Peter Werbe. Coming up next.
SBC, going beyond the call.
At KFC, we know how you feel about Mondays. Nobody likes Mondays, so we make Tuesday tastier. Now every Tuesday, get a country fried steak meal for just $1.99. That's right, a KFC country fried steak meal for just $1.99. Treat yourself to Southern-style country fried steak smothered in our special recipe white pepper gravy, served with mashed potatoes, coleslaw, and our famous buttermilk biscuit. All that great food for just $1.99 every Tuesday. A deal this good can only happen once a week, and since nobody likes Mondays, we make Tuesdays tastier. Hey, with this $1.99 meal deal, maybe Tuesday should be called Less Than Tuesday. Get it? $1.99 Less Than Tuesday? KFC's Country Fried Steak Meal with gravy, mashed potatoes, coleslaw, and a biscuit for just $1.99 this Tuesday and every Tuesday. Only at Kentucky Fried Chicken, Chicken Capital USA. Tax extra, only at participating KFC locations.
101 WRIF Detroit. Call in with your comments at 313-298-WRIF. Now, Night Call returns. Here's Peter Werbe.
And this year, for the first time, we must offer every child in America 3 nuclear missiles.
Here's a reason for everything. Baby, who is
recession, stock market declines.
Hackman's looking for his home. Three kids and a wife in a pile of rubble, and the Yankees just gave the word. The towers are on fire and they're coming in trouble, and I'm just sitting here watching it all from my solid state bubble, yeah.
Thank you. Welcome back. WRF's Night Call. You know, I'm really remiss. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce the singer that song, singer-songwriter Nathan Slonowski. Yeah, that must be it. Slonowski. Right. Nathan Slonowski, I would say. So if I'm butchering it, Nate, write in. Good stuff. Who rules the world? And I thought a little country music there, a little country-based music. Here's who supports Bush: Clint Black, Pat Boone, Brooks and Dunn, the Gatlin Brothers, Reba McEntire, Wayne Newton, Kid Rock. What the hell? Kid Rock, Britney Spears, Leanne Womack. For Carrie, Bruce Springsteen, Dave Matthews, Good Charlotte, John Mellencamp, Pearl Jam, R.E.M. Well, what does that tell us? All right, let's go back. Oh, Howard Zinn. Why didn't I mention this earlier? The eminent historian Howard Zinn, whose book, A People's History of the United States, has sold over a million copies, more than any history book in the history of the United States. So we'll be talking with him. He has a new companion book that's incredibly interesting. We'll get to that. We're going to line three. Yeah, Dan Letarski, I haven't even mentioned your name. Thank you so much for being our producer tonight and our phone screener. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is Paul from Plymouth.
Hi, Paul.
I just want to share with you that I'm a candidate for Plymouth Township Trustee. I'm running nonpartisan with no political party affiliation, independent, in other words.
Okay.
I just want to share something about, I saw the Detroit News and Free Press article this morning about not endorsing either candidate.
Yeah, that was incredible.
I was surprised. But I want to share with you a little bit about what's going on in my community. For the past 12 years, we've had candidates come and go for this office or many offices. And time again, the papers endorse Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Each and every time, new candidates, Democrat, independents, and other parties come to the table with new ideas. And the papers just keep going with the parties that seem to be in control of things.
Well, they're part of the racket.
Right. And, you know, it seems like all our citizens, we see what's going on in our community. We're a small little town of 30,000 people. In the city, it's 10,000, a little less than 10,000. And it used to be a place of mom-and-pops businesses, small sandwich shops, bookstores, restaurants. And suddenly, we're being overwhelmed with corporations. And it seems to be dominated by this Republican Party. That is simply putting in the big corporate giants. Our little hardwares are going out. The bookstores are going out. Sandwich shops are going out for the big corporations, and the people just are apathetic.
Well, I think therein lies the problem, because as good a candidate as you may be, as good-hearted as you may be, the programs, the strength of the programs you may be advocating may be good ones as well, but as long as people are doing next to little and voting once every 2 to 4 years, in my mind, comes near to being almost next to nothing, we're arguably just going to have more of the same. Maybe, and I'll use without knowing you or knowing what you're advocating, give you the benefit of the doubt and thinking that we can once in a while get somebody in there that has some good program, some good heart. But mostly it's going to be as money begins to, big money begins to dominate, as you're saying correctly, begins to dominate absolutely everything, and there's no space whatsoever for just small enterprises. There's not much hope. In other words, the hope lies, as it always has in American history from its very origins, in the passionate involvement of the citizenry in what is happening to us. And as people are going to sit back, be the spectators to their life, well, they just better hope that these big corporations are going to take care of them, which they won't.
Right. I'm just so disappointed that, you know, most of these candidates come to the table with no substance. They just think that they're reelected. Most of them said, you're never going to beat us, and, you know, you shouldn't even run. It's very discouraging. a lot of the time, you know, although you got to keep moving on, win or lose.
Yeah, and you don't sound real, you sound, what's the word I'm looking for? How are you? So I won't guess at it. You don't sound very hopeful, I guess, is the...
Oh, no, I'm very hopeful.
Are you?
I'm still out on the campaign trail every day. I'm personally delivering flyers to every house personally and knocking on doors. I got about 8,000 more to do in the next week.
Mm-hmm.
But none of these other guys are doing anything. They're not even put out their political signs. Through the primary, they just covered the town with stuff. But they've said, we think we've got it. We don't need to do anything more. You know, and it's, but...
Well, every once in a while, this is the stuff that Hollywood movies are made of. The little guy, all of a sudden, just comes from behind, surprises them all. Of course, when you do, next time, if you win, next time those will be saying, Paul, let us buy you some fancy signs, and, right?
No, I'm going to stay small. Hey, can I share something else with you, Peter?
Yeah.
I just brought another listener to you this evening.
Oh, well, thank you.
My godmother, she's 84 years old. She's tuning in right now. She's born in Austria, and she loves the show.
Well, thank you, and greetings to her. I appreciate her listening. We have quite a spread. Every once in a while I get calls or particularly email. People say, I'm 12 or 13 years old. Well, good. Cross-generational.
Hey, thanks, Peter. Hey, what did you think of the story this morning? Isn't that great that they didn't endorse anyone?
I was completely flabbergasted because the man that runs the editorial page of the Detroit News, Nolan Finley, is a notorious right-winger, a vicious man, and a militant neoconservative. So I was surprised. Maybe just the higher-up said, this Bush... For one thing, a lot of big money in this society, that it's represented, say, by the New York Times, think that Bush is really awful for domestic and international business. That's why they support Kerry.
Does this mean maybe times are changing, that they're going to look at an independent candidate or someone like Ralph Nader down the road, or that...
Detroit News, well...
maybe there'll be a third party down the road, maybe... It takes 10 or 20 years?
Who knows? Well, I don't know. People have been talking about it for a long time. Let's hope. But again, it's what it really takes is people mobilize at the grassroots. And we found we can do anything. We can found a country. We can abolish slavery. We can create labor unions. We can give women the vote. We can end wars. But you can't do it sitting at your house watching TV.
That's right, Peter.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your time.
Best of luck. Let us know what happens after the election. 313-298-WRIF, 15 minutes, and we'll hear my interview with Howard Zinn. Let's see here. We'll go to line 4. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on the air right now.
All right. My name is Heather Williams. I am completely disgusted with the way our country works.
Hmm.
For everything is corrupt, from school boards to state legislature, FDA to the presidency. It's absurd. And I don't like how our candidates want to do things. For example, Kerry wants to raise the minimum wage $7. I'm all for getting a raise, but wouldn't that cause serious inflation?
Well, that's always been, he doesn't want to raise it $7. He wants to raise it to $7, right?
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant.
Although I might be, you'll probably think I'm crazier than Kerry. I would be for raising it to $7, or raising it by $7, so it would be $12.15 an hour minimum wage. Well, there always is the charge that if the minimum wage is raised a quarter, so I mean, they were talking about raising it 25 cents, so it would be like $5.40. They would say that X number of young people would lose their jobs, and that the retailers would just pass along the cost to the consumer. So essentially we'd be right back where we started. But actually, when they've done these studies, it doesn't happen. They just can't automatically do that because it can't be competitive. So other countries in Europe, for instance, have minimum wages that are much higher, double what the United States is, and they seem to be doing all right.
Well, it's a nice idea, but it's like every time they hear that somebody, especially in the military, when they find out that they're going to be getting a raise,
mm-hmm,
of some sort, of some percentage, let's say they get a 2% raise, the prices for everything goes up 3 to 5%.
What, I mean, like in military bases?
Yeah. Because I have a friend at work whose husband was in the military, and so she tells me all these things.
Well, why can't they be controlled? I mean, that's federal. I don't know whether those are private contractors. I suspect they're probably private contractors at military bases. That kind of activity can be controlled. And if we want our citizens to be waged decently in the richest country in the world, I mean, how can the richest country in the world have the lowest minimum wage of the industrialized country? If people won't, if people insist, for instance, large companies insist on passing along the raise that people just got, so the rest of us have to pay for it. Well, maybe they have to be prohibited by law from doing that.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I want to talk about is how the Bush or the Republicans got Nader on the ballot.
Oh,
Great idea, right? But how come, I believe that if they're going to put Nader on the ballot, they should also let him be part of the debate, but that's already passed and gone. But I think that's only fair.
Well, that was an interesting argument, yeah. I think people are a little too worried about Nader. The people I know that are voting for Nader most of the people I know that voted for Nader are voting for Kerry this year, the diehards, and my hat's off to them, because they're standing by their principles regardless. They wouldn't vote for Kerry in any event. And I've actually talked to people that voted for Bush in 2000 that are now intending to vote for Kerry. So we'll see what that's going to siphon off. Particularly, I think people that see this as an extraordinarily tight race have the feeling, like my mother so often did. She very frequently wanted to vote for a third party, and by the end of the election, right before it, she'd say, "I just can't let that dreadful whoever the Republican happened to be," and then she would always wind up voting for the Democrat, even if she didn't fully agree with him. Well, Heather, I got to take some more calls. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, bye. Oh, I wanted to say thank you to the people at oldamericancentury.org, oldamericancentury.org, and they're concerned about this project for the new American century. This is behind the war in Iraq and lots of other problems we're having in our country. There are the Cheneys and the Rumsfeld and the Wolfowitzes and what have you, Karl Rove and Jeb Bush, people like that. And they sent me this great T-shirt, so thank you for that. You can see all their stuff at oldamericancentury.org. They're kind enough to send it to me. All right. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good, thanks.
What I was basically calling for is I'm not for Republicans or Democrats. I'm for whoever does the best for the job at the time, president. Basically, I'm voting for Kerry. I agree 100%. Bush is not getting the job done over in Iraq. But I'd like to hear more positive things from you on Kerry. Basically, you know, what I mean, I'm for the stem cell research. And, you know, there's very vague things that are making me lean towards Kerry right now. But anybody but Bush, you know.
Well, I probably am guilty of that a lot, but what I'm hoping is that Kerry, at a minimum, will be able to reverse the damage that Bush has done to America in the last 4 years, and that is at least restore all of these executive orders that have been rescinded by Bush. That there, you know, there's this is just anti-Bush, but if you go to this website called thousandreasons.org, and it's on my website if that's easier for you, and it's astounding. I mean, when Democrats criticized Republicans in 2000 or 96 or 86 or 1926, something like that, they'd have 10 or 12 complaints against the incumbent or the Republican. This is beyond belief what that Bush and his gang have unraveled of what has, in some cases, been over 100 years of protection for Americans and the middle class and women and the working class and minorities and the environment. So,
well, I agree 100%. I had my own business until last year, and thanks to Bush, you know, with the economy going just, I mean, 9/11 had a little bit of effect on it, but it still did well, but it's just, with the tax breaks, it's the upper class, and You know, the one other thing that really bothers me more than anything is they say the veterans for or disabled veterans for Bush. You know, my wife's a disabled veteran, and they're categorizing everybody together. And I can tell you right now, she's voting for Kerry. I mean,
well,
for them to sit there and categorize everybody into that column, I think that's very wrong for veterans because, you know, they have their own opinions too, you know.
There's a tremendous number of veterans groups that are supporting Kerry. One thing, there's a Veterans for Kerry group. There is also Military Families for Common Sense. There is all these family groups that are opposing, that have sons and daughters in Iraq now that are opposing the war. I mean, they're not the majority, but they've been almost made invisible by the media. That's part of the whole propaganda effort. But here, all right. I don't know that at this point, Kerry does not have the capacity to do very much positive. I mean, this country is broke. It's in debt. And what Kerry has to do is say, hey, look, well, he said it. We're going to repeal those tax breaks on people making over $200,000 a year.
That's where I tend to differ on with a middle-class tax break. Why not just across the board not give any tax breaks at the time being and, like, pay off the deficit?
Well, we might have to do that, but if the wealthy and the corporations paid a fair share of taxes, we could have like a $50,000 deductible on everyone's income very easily. But what is expected now, if you're making $55,000-$60,000 a year, which is even with that amount, if you want to live a middle class lifestyle, that's not a ton of money these days. Whereas people that are making $400,000-$600,000 a year, they don't need any tax relief. It's the middle class that needs tax relief.
Yep.
Okay.
I agree. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. I'm sorry to hear about your business. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Hey, this is Matt from Redford. I was just wondering, what do you think of what's going on in Florida? How they're doing like a pre-voting before the November 2nd vote?
Well, man,
considering that it's already being all screwed up, I mean.
Well, how does it look? You know, one thing about officers of the law, like judges and what have you, not only should they, of course, adhere to the law, they also want to. They never want to have the appearance of corruption. So what does it mean when you have the brother of the guy that's running in an election that was pretty dubious 4 years ago? And again, the person that's in charge of the whole voting system and counting the votes is a Republican partisan, the Secretary of State of Florida. So it gives the appearance of corruption right from the beginning.
Right, exactly. It's kind of, I mean, it's also a Republican party that is running all these polls, these opinion polls that are on like CNN and everything, and
sure.
So it's kind of, what does this mean for the rest of the country that's going to vote in other states like here in Michigan or in, you know, Ohio or something?
I don't know. Here's my perverse dream, is that Kerry loses the popular vote but wins in the Electoral College. Just kidding. Paying Bush back. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you with me? Do. All right. We can do this. Is there more calls? Okay. We put everybody on hold, because normally I do commercials right there. That's what, right, Dan? You thought we were going to, but we didn't have any, and I didn't tell you. So we'll just play this little, you know, introduction, and then it's Howard Zinn, the eminent historian. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Next Sunday, the last program before the election. Ooh.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Rayburn Golf Club. Rayburn. When do those leaks start again?
Are you done yet? You said 5 minutes. That was an hour ago. Are you avoiding me?
Daddy, can I try? Is it my turn yet?
I can't swing the club with you on it.
Rayburn, take me away.
Rayburn Golf Club in Plymouth, home of the Monster, a 617-yard par 5 double dogleg, an 18-hole championship course known for its fast undulating greens. It has one of Michigan's toughest public golf
Well, there has to be foundation texts. You have to have a clear view of who we are and how history developed. And without it, I guess I think you're kind of lost. And in fact, on the occasion of Columbus Day, you may have heard me read from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, where he recounts Columbus's words upon encountering the Arawaks, where after the end of the day of meeting these wonderful native people, he says they will make wonderful servants. Well, joining me again on the Peter Werby Show is Howard Zinn, the author of A People's History of the United States and co-author of a companion book called Voices of a People's History of the United States, along with Anthony Arnov, who is the co-editor of this. And these are selected testimonies to the histories that appear. Howard Zinn, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Peter.
These are absolutely amazing. Was it a task or was it enjoyable compiling all of this?
It was both.
Yeah.
It was enjoyable. Yeah, it's always enjoyable, sort of kind of detective work, you know, reading over stuff and looking for just the right things and then finding things that you like. And I mean, it's hard. It's hard work. You have to go through a lot of things. You have to do a lot of digging, but in the end, it's very satisfying to come up with the words of really eloquent people, passionate people, who have voiced their indignation or their joy at some event in American history.
Now, tell me about your co-author, Anthony Arnov. Very frequently, when there's a prominent author such as yourself, although Anthony Arnov, an author and editor in his own right, he edited Terrorism and War with you and also has written Iraq Under Siege. But oftentimes, when there's one prominent author, it's the co-author that does all the work.
You mean like these movie stars?
Yeah.
As told to...
Yeah.
Truth is, Anthony did an awful lot of work on it, and if I had to say who did more, probably he did. Although this is not one of those situations where I sat back, he did the work, and then I plunked my name onto it. I would never do that. No. We both worked on picking out stuff and consulting with one another. But Anthony was very, very important in this.
And also you wrote the introduction to the text.
Yeah, I wrote the introduction. I wrote most of the little introductions to each reading. Anthony probably did most of the digging, and I would say, you know, see if you can find something on the mutinies in the American Revolution. And Anthony would go to the library and dig something out and dig five things out and say, what shall we use? Shall we use this or shall we use that? So in the end, we consulted about what we should choose.
Now, this brand new compilation, Voices of a People's History of the United States, that's published by Seven Stories Press, it's 665 pages, given...
You're trying to scare people, aren't you?
Well, you can read them one by one. Some are a few pages, some are just short little statements. And
it would be too much to ask people to read it from cover to cover, but, yeah, it's the kind of thing you sort of browse in and, you know, and sort of find things that you like, and... So it's not so formidable when you think of the 600-odd pages that way.
Well, it could have been 1,000 or 16,000.
Sure.
When you said, Anthony Arnov, your co-author, said, well, here's five. I'm sure you probably thought, I'd like to put in all five. What was the criteria for assessing them?
Well, the criteria was not to have too much repetition. In other words... If we're dealing with the removal of the five civilized tribes, which takes place in the 1830s, where the American army drives the Indians living in the southeastern states, drive them westward across the Mississippi, there are a number of really interesting things on it, but I figured, no, we don't need more than one, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there are, you know, when you're dealing with slavery, there are a bunch of wonderful letters that slaves who had escaped and who are now living in the North wrote back to their masters. Very often when their masters wrote to them and said, it's hard to believe, said, hey, why don't you come back? Yeah. What was your complaint? You know, we treated you nicely and so on. And there are letters. You say, well, we would choose one of them, you know.
Well, many of the selections in this compilation are familiar to people, everybody from Columbus to, I'm kind of looking just through the first pages here, and Thomas Paine and Black Elk and people like that, Henry David Thoreau. And on the other hand, the whole thrust of the book that this is a companion to, A People's History of the United States, really tells, in fact, that, a people's history, the individuals who, other than the great men and generals.
Yeah.
So how many of these texts do you think would be familiar to people?
I would say a very small number would be familiar to people. For instance, you know, on the war on Mexico, the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, well, people would be familiar with Henry David Thoreau.
Mm-hmm.
And his essay on civil disobedience. They would not at all be familiar with the diary of Colonel Hitchcock, who was in the war and who wrote about it. They would not be, you know, familiar to the handbill that was passed out among people, soldiers, to urge them to desert the army. And although they would know the name of Frederick Douglass, they would not really know his speech to the New England Convention about the Mexican War. I would say that 80% of the material in this book would be material that people would not know about.
I guess I would agree, because I've used your book for years, certainly very few of the texts are familiar to me. I'm really looking forward to getting through a lot of them. Parenthetically, maybe we should mention, in fact, I think it's been a while since we spoke, because I know we spoke right before there was going to be a celebration in New York City. Was it in February of 2003 to celebrate the 1 millionth copy of A People's History of the United States?
Yes.
Absolutely unprecedented in American publishing. This is a hard question, Howard Zinn, because I'm going to ask you about modesty and how can you speak modestly about being modest. But what was it like to be a historian and to be celebrated at a celebration in New York City?
Well, I could be modest and say, oh, it didn't mean anything to me. But no, it was it felt wonderful, actually. It felt wonderful to, there's this double factor. You know, one, there's the ego factor, which you can't avoid, you know, which is there. You know, here, you know, I wrote the book, A People's History of the United States. On the other hand, the other factor is that a million people would want to read and buy a book that is really a book by a dissident, which takes a dissident's view of American history, which takes a critical look at the establishment, which takes a very skeptical look at the president and Congress and the Supreme Court, and takes a very harsh look at the nation's wars. That a million people in the United States would want to buy such a book is very encouraging to me. So, sure, it feels good to be celebrated for having written a book, but what feels just as good, or maybe even more important, is what it says about the openness of the reading public to a new viewpoint about our country, our society, where it has been, where it is going.
My guest is Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States. This is the history book that's sold over a million copies now. And we're talking about his companion text called Voices of a People's History of the United States, which includes everybody from Frederick Douglass to Susan B. Anthony, Chief Joseph, Martin Luther King Jr., Sacco and Vanzetti, the singer Patti Smith, and also Bruce Springsteen, Mark Twain, and actually a lot of people who I don't mention because, as Howard Zinn said earlier, these are not household names, but they are people that formed history, that created the debates and made history, didn't sit back and wait for it to happen to them. One other thing, and I think this was way down the drain before we talked last, and that was this film project with Matt Damon that of all networks, Fox News or Fox Network was talking about airing, and you said, well, last time we talked, which was quite a while ago, well, it doesn't look like this is going to happen. Any progress on that?
No regress. That is no. That fell through. Like 90% of the projects that are talked about in Hollywood fall through, and Fox. Well, you're right. It's sort of an oddity that Fox Television would want to make a series based on a people's history. And we were all surprised, but we went along with it. And maybe at a certain point, Rupert Murdoch actually read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally he said, what are we doing here? I don't know the reason why they dropped it, but they did. Then it went on to HBO, and we felt better about HBO because HBO is more daring and is not bound, you know, by the right-wing ideology of Murdoch. And HBO actually hired writers to write scripts, very good writers, John Sayles among them.
Really?
And John Sayles wrote a fine script about the Lowell Mill Girls of the 1830s. But after the scripts were turned in, HBO said, no, forget it. They dropped it, too. What's happening now is that, and this is happening also with the help of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and Chris Moore, their friend and producer. The three of them have always been a kind of troika, always been working together. And the three of them are now helping out with a New York documentary group, which is working on producing not feature films, which is what Fox and HBO were going to do, but a sort of a six-part documentary based on episodes from people's history. So that is in the works. Now, whether that will happen, I don't know. All of these projects, any project I think that has to do with video, television, movies, anything that involves a lot of money to be laid out is always dubious. Whereas, you know, writing a book or getting a book published is a lot easier. There's less investment involved, less risk involved for publishers. But, no, TV stuff, movie stuff, it's always a long shot. But then again, the Red Sox were a long shot.
What a game.
Yes.
What a game.
Yes.
Howard Zinn's latest is A Voices of People's History of the United States, published by Seven Stories. You can go to sevenstories.com. It'll also be on my website, peterwerby.com. Now, where are we in the editions? I know I have three, and you'll have to tell me how many there are. That is to say that history keeps moving along. Your history book was originally published in 1980, so obviously a lot has happened. Where are we up to now in the editions that are available?
Well, the latest edition of A People's History of the United States, the latest edition brings the story up to the election of 2000 and the war on terrorism.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty up-to-date. The last chapter, in fact, my last chapter is called the 2000 election and the war on terrorism. And well, the war in Iraq had not yet begun when I wrote it, but the war on Afghanistan had begun. And I would say that, you know, basically the things that I say there about the Bush administration, the things that I say in that last chapter about the war on terrorism are as applicable to the Iraq situation as they were to Afghanistan.
Now, I guess I have the one right before that. Good. I'll add another to my collection. Tell me a little about the sources. When what are these most of these documents that are reprinted in Voices of a People's History of the United States? These were sources that were written out and then saved, I assume, right? Everything from Columbus's diary to a speech by Helen Keller opposing World War One.
Yeah, they've all, you know, they've all appeared in publications which are sort of buried deep in libraries, and so it's a matter of, you know, doing a lot of digging in libraries, and Anthony is very good also at going on the web and finding, you know, the web somehow comes up with amazing things.
It does.
You know, here, you know, we have Muhammad Ali speaking out against the Vietnam War, and I suppose you can do that in two ways. You can go back to the newspapers of that time and find what Muhammad Ali says. Or you could probably go to the Internet and type in Muhammad Ali, and one of the things that you'd get in that would be what he said when he opposed the war in Vietnam. So,
Well, you actually bring me right to my point, interestingly, and it would be that the web giveth, the web taketh away. I know you're familiar with the Labadie collection at the University of Michigan that has the papers of so many dissidents and radicals.
Yes.
And the curator, Julie Harada, in her quest to be able to be the, you know, to assemble the material that she needs for the archive, took up Yiddish to be able to read the handwritten diaries of Jewish radicals of the early part of the 20th century.
Really? That's ingenious of her.
It is, but now, of course, yeah, all this stuff is going out on the Internet. There are no records of so frequently of the debates, of the statements, of the faction fights and what have you. Is this dispiriting? It actually is to me.
Well, I'm not totally happy with it. I have mixed feelings about it because, you know, in many ways, you know, it's so much easier now to get data. But there's always a worry that this data is ephemeral. This data is hanging out there in the air, and you can grab it and hold on to it. But tomorrow it may disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I'm totally wrong on this, you know, technologically. But it doesn't. I'll put it another way. When newspapers began to be available on, you know, on reel, you know,
mm-hmm,
go to the library and you get out a reel, New York Times, 1946, and microfilm. And the newspapers became available on microfilm. And, you know, I wasn't happy about that. Even though, I could go to the, you know, go to the machine and wind up the microphone and you know, and find something. But I really liked it when I was going to the library, and they had the volumes of the New York Times in these huge books, and you would put one of those books on a table, and you would flip it over, and there was the actual old New York Times,
sure,
which you could read, you know. And somehow that seems more human to me.
Yeah, it does. I think he's well-known. Norman Pollack, who wrote on the populist movement is a professor of mine at Wayne State University.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And he talked about going through these populist papers in Broken Bow, Oklahoma.
Mm.
But I don't know. Maybe we're... But the problem is, though, that it's not which is more preferable, whether you could see this online in these PDFs or whether you could actually see the actual document. Problem is that a lot of what used to occur, these voluminous letters, say, of Emma Goldman,
mm-hmm,
feminist and anarchist from the early or to the almost mid 20th century, her letters, they'd be on the Internet. They'd be gone. That's the problem, I think.
Yeah, well, but one of the things that's happening, though, is that they're publishing a lot of documents, which otherwise you would have to go to the library or get an interlibrary loan. And your mention of Emma Goldman reminded me that, you know, there's a huge amount of Emma Goldman material, but where, how do you get it? You
right.
see, some of it you would get online. Some of it you'd have to visit. There's a Emma Goldman Papers Project out at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
University of California, Berkeley. And what they are doing is they are selecting from this huge amount of Emma Goldman material and publishing it in big volumes. So they're going to have a lot of volumes. And they've already done one volume. The second volume is coming out. And these volumes are wonderful because they have documentary material in them that hasn't appeared anywhere else. Because, you know, the Emma Goldman Papers Project just assembles letters and leaflets and pamphlets and newspaper articles and, you know, things that you would have to work very, very hard to get hold of and, you know, to printing them.
Well,
so that's useful.
In your book, Voices of a People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn, you have quite a few entries for Emma Goldman. If you're listening, people, and don't know who Emma Goldman is, I actually extended her life a little bit beyond when it was. I believe she died in 1939. But an incredible woman, once called the most dangerous woman in America. You know, we're almost out of time. I actually didn't notice in here. I've read in Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, he goes on and talks about the Lincoln-Douglas debate and the quality of the discourse. That's going too. I mean, in some future edition of Voices of a People's History of the United States, do you think you would have the speeches of John Kerry or George Bush?
That's
a leading question. No.
No. No. No, but that brings me to a point. One of our criteria in choosing things was simply eloquence and style and the vividness of writing, you see. And you know, I would have a Vietnam veteran speaking about what he saw at My Lai, and it would be gripping eloquence. No, a speech by George Bush or John Kerry? Absolutely not. On the other hand, you know, it's true that in the old days, there was a lot more eloquence coming from the public platform. In this book, the speech that Frederick Douglass delivers, you know, on the 4th of July, back in the 1850s, which is just a magnificent piece of oratory. Even on the printed page, too bad we don't have a tape of him. But yes, eloquence is something we don't find much of these days.
Well, was it Goebbels or somebody who said, we speak to create an effect. We only have about 60 seconds left. I see on page 481, Losing Control in the 70s, you reprint then a rather obscure history professor, Howard Zinn. The problem is civil disobedience.
A little embarrassing that we print in my book, we print one of my things, and truth is, I didn't choose it.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't veto it either.
Okay. We are out of time.
Okay.
My guest has been Howard Zinn, along with Anthony Arnov. They've published Voices of a People's History of the United States. It's the companion volume to the national bestseller, A People's History of the United States. I'd highly recommend it. Again, you can go to 7storiespress.com or to my website, peterwerby.com. Howard Zinn, a pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
At First Horizon Home Loans, we know you go through a lot when you buy a home, and it can get a little nerve-wracking. From negotiating the price to inspections, even making sure repairs are made. But there's at least one thing that's a little less stressful. Getting your loan from First Horizon. We draw on the strength of a nationwide network of loan officers who will guide you every step of the way. First Horizon has all kinds of programs for all kinds of buyers. We'll help you select the one that best fits your needs so you can take care of other things, like choosing new furniture, designing a deck or patio, Well, you get the idea. We'll make it easy and give you the options you need. First Horizon Home Loans. Get home with less stress.
Call Mike Jenkins at First Horizon Home Loans today at 877-505-8600, extension 222, and get home with less stress. That's 877-505-8600, extension 222. Loan subject to credit approval, equal housing lender. Getting ready to move into your new home? Got a business to relocate? Need help moving and packing delicate or fragile stuff? For your moving needs, don't bother calling the middleman when you can go straight to the boss. The professionals at Boss Moving and Service. Boss Moving and Service has been family owned and operated for over 20 years. They specialize in local moving with a fleet of 9 trucks. They carry a full line of packing materials. They're licensed by the state and fully insured. Boss is also your home and business relocation specialist. Whether it's one item, a piano, or organ, maybe a delicate antique or an entire truckload. Whatever you need to make your move go smoother, Boss Moving and Service has you covered. Compare Boss Moving's low prices to the other guys, and you'll learn what others in Metro Detroit have known for years. Don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss. Call the professionals at Boss Moving and Service toll-free at 800-706-6644. Call today for a free in-home estimate at 800-706-6644. Remember, don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Coach Nick Saban after his loss to Auburn over the weekend, and we had to get his thoughts on his replacement, Jonnell Smith.
I think he's doing a fine job, but first of all, three words, collagen rebuilding serum. if he's leading the Big Ten in anything, it's dead epidermal cells. I don't think 10 minutes in a tanning bed would kill the guy either.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't like to pass advice along. I let the guy make his own mistakes.
Well, you know, he's pretty pasty looking, actually. You're right.
I think that's why he left Louisville. They used the gray for the coaching shirts, and he looked so washed out and ashy. I think a guy complected like that, at some point, has got to coach a team that has primary colors.
Well, Nick, not to bring this whole thing down, but what went wrong against Auburn?
Well, you mix together an unfamiliar 1875 Revlon with a Bumble and Bumble Stylers, throwing some unforeseen humidity, and that's what you get.
That's not like you to blame defeat on weather conditions, though.
I'm not talking about the game. I'm talking about that sweat-soaked, wind-blown mess on the top of my head.
Drew and Mike in the morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
101-101.
Riff.
When it's 5 o'clock, it's time to rock with the Riff.
Weekday afternoons at 5, right here on 101 WRIF.
Your ride home rocks with Big Daddy Arthur P. Playing your Riff Rockin' Requests. Call in your Riff Rockin' Request to the Grand Poobah at 313-298-WRIF.
Email them to arthurp@wrif.com.
Hell, you can even fax them in before you ditch the office at 248-398-6219. Call for the tunes that you want to hear. Win yourself some killer Riff swag and let the ride home rock with the Riff's own Big Daddy Arthur Penala.
Riff is the only station letting you pick your favorites and program the station three times a day at noon, 5, and 9.
It's your all-request Riff Rock and Ride Home with Big Daddy Arthur P.
On the Mother City's one and only, home of rock and roll,
101 WRIF.
Riff.
Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with Maury Povich.
Drew and Mike, you are not the father.
Oh, thank God. That's great. We're going to use that time and time again in our life.
What is the longest and the most attempts it's taken to find the father?
Periodically, we do these paternity updates.
Right.
Keep bringing the women back.
Yeah.
We have Georgetta on for her 10th time.
Her 10th time?
How many guys did she sleep with in this 1 month?
We're just trying to figure it out.
You know what's funny, too, is that a lot of times when the guy's pronounced the father, and up till then it's been, ah, you ho, and right. There's no way to... And then when he is the father, it's always cracks me up how they're like, oh, no, I'm going to take care of the baby, and I'm always thinking, like, yeah, right, like 2 weeks from now, you are so gone. Which is funny, too, Maury, when it turns out like he's not the father, and she's absolutely convinced of it, and then, of course, she runs backstage absolutely crying and bawling, and you have to hug her.
Right.
Please tell me that you're not as sincere as you seem to be.
Right. What you figure out is that after about the fourth or fifth time with a particular woman, they all know the exits better than I do.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Yes. The broadcast program. On the Riff.
101.1.
Riff rocks the West Side Tuesday night.
It's Party Central on the West Side this Tuesday night with 101 WRIF at Snookers Pullin' Pub. In Livonia on the northwest corner of Schoolcraft and Inkster, just off I-96. Yeah! Join Meltdown, the big unit, for the biggest Tuesday night party in the Motor City. Join in the WRIF Pool Challenge to score awesome Riff prizes. Like CDs, t-shirts, tickets, and so much more. Come on out and see what you've been missing Tuesday nights with the Riff at Snookers.
Not yet.
That's this Tuesday night at the Westside Party Command Center.
Yeah, I just came from my house, my home where I live, and it's made of wooden brick. It's got wood floors, stuff like that. We take that for granted, except for a few million in this country, in the United States, all throughout North America. We take our house, living in a home, for granted. Yet, that's not true all across the world. In fact, there may be billions that are underhoused. A book came my way, extraordinary book, actually. It's called Building Without Borders, Sustainable Construction for the Global Village. It's edited by Joseph F. F. Kennedy. And Joseph F. Kennedy he co-founded Builders Without Borders. It's an international consortium of natural builders and architects serving homeless and underhoused populations. And he teaches ecological design and natural building at New College of California. And Joe Kennedy, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
And where is New College of California?
We are based in Santa Rosa, which is just north of San Francisco.
A wonderful town.
Yes.
Actually. All right. Building Without Borders, that phrase is reminiscent of like Doctors Without Borders. And the idea, what sort of the idea behind the concept of the group that you founded?
Well, there were a number of us who had been working in the natural building field for the last 10 years or so, or the previous 10 years, to the point when we started the organization in 1999. And we realized that we were influenced and inspired by cultures that are in the so-called developing world or third world. And we were realizing as well that many of the traditional architecture styles were going out of fashion or being actively destroyed in those very cultures that we were most inspired by. So we realized that we needed to do something to bring back or to show that the Westerners that are often seen as living just in the fancy houses on TV were indeed interested and wanting to know more about the traditional styles,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to go to those places and see to how we could help those people live more decently with what they had at hand.
Well, tell us about that, about what sustainable building is. On the cover of your book that you edited, there is straw and mud. Looks a little mush-pushy to the average Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the cover of Building Without Borders. What does it mean to build with sustainable natural substances?
Well, the idea is that we are so dependent on materials that are heavily manufactured, which has a lot of what's called embodied energy and money and capital-intensive processes, that it's out of the reach for most people around the world. And our contention is that you can build perfectly fine and beautiful houses using materials that are locally available, like earth and straw and stone, local wood resources, etc., and that it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. The resulting structures can be culturally continuous with historical examples, which we've been building houses for tens of thousands of years, and certainly we haven't had Home Depots for all that time. So we've mm-hmm. learned to work with what we've had, and there's a huge example base that we can learn from in terms of the ways that we built before the age of oil and all of the sort of artificially supported methods that we now rely upon.
Including, there's a lot in this, and that what's on the cover is straw bale housing. Most people can't imagine living in a house made of straw bales, but that's not even, that's a method that was even used in the United States here.
That's right. That was started back in the late 1800s in Nebraska. And what we're finding that is, in fact, we need to revisit these ideas because they make so much sense for today. They're not just old-fashioned or going back into living into mud huts or what have you. We're not returning to some romantic idol that we are imagining that would be better than what we have now. But in fact, looking at the technology of building with these materials, seeing how they work together, how we can put them together to make modern, beautiful, exciting buildings that are also light on the planet.
Well, I somehow imagine, Joe Kennedy, someone saying, now, wait a minute, they are actually talking about living in a house made of straw bales? Isn't this going to, like, burn up in a second? Isn't this going to be, you know, cold at the wrong time and hot at the wrong time and fall down in about 2 weeks?
Well, in fact, all of those concerns, what we find from our testing is the exact opposite is the case, is that once they're plastered, straw bale houses are much more difficult to burn than, in fact, wood frame houses are. Some feel that the soft nature of the bales makes it ideal for seismic areas because they will just kind of vibrate instead of breaking apart like a brick building might. And the other issues as far as pests and such are really unfounded. They're just based on some fairy tales in terms of the three little pigs and such. So what we're finding, in fact, is that the best moral there is to just not let a pig build your house.
Exactly. Can straw bale houses pass zoning ordinances?
In many parts of the country, they're fairly mainstream construction right now. It really started in Arizona, in Pima County, where Tucson is centered, and has spread from there. There's a number of, I think, 50 or 60 straw bale houses just in Sonoma County alone. And there's at least 1,000 or maybe 10,000 now. I've lost track of how many are being built. It's gone from a pioneering building method to largely mainstream within just the last 10 years or so.
I was actually in one in rural Tennessee that people had put together, and it was quite an interesting place. My guest is Joseph F. Kennedy. He's edited Building Without Borders, Sustainable Construction for the Global Village, and we're looking at a situation where billions in this world are currently underhoused, and I assume that your concern here isn't just architectural. Is that correct?
No, it has to do as well with access to land, the sort of media onslaught in terms of the sociological impacts of Western culture on traditional societies, the whole financial and economic aspects of these things. It's an extremely complex problem, and unfortunately, most so-called development work approaches this complex problem in a very simplistic fashion and causes mostly failure. And so we're trying to learn from those mistakes, not go in and repeat them again, and really seeing that the best approach is to come in a spirit of partnership as opposed that we're going to come and help somebody, but really seeing that it's a two-way street because we have as much to learn from other cultures here in the West as they do from us.
Well, when you look through Building Without Borders, you see, extraordinary examples of oftentimes very poor people or people that are willing to look at new methods, like even in this country, of the way you can build housing. But are you familiar with Mike Davis's article, Planet of Slums?
I just read that article and am very appalled.
Depressed, I would say. But so I suspect that with most people that do this kind of work, that that your interest is in getting people housing. Yet when Mike Davis's article talks about these new cities, many of the names I'd never even heard of, with sometimes millions of people in them, it almost seems like a problem that's unsolvable. Did it have that same depressive effect on you?
Well, actually, it didn't. I've been doing a lot of my work in South Africa. And I had a chance to go there last year, and I'm going to be returning there this November. And I had a chance to go through the townships and to see what was there. And in some ways, it's a dire situation in many ways. And what I saw was very much reflective of the type of thing that Mike Davis was writing about. But what I've realized is that what our biggest lack is human creativity, and certainly resources can help as well. So one of my main interests right now is develop a style of building that uses those materials that are available to the typical so-called slum dweller and find some way of using those same materials to create an architecture that is more honorable, more life-affirming, but not depending on something outside. So reconfiguring the worst-case scenario and trying to find a way to make something beautiful of it. So that's what I'm really seeing is increasingly my work in the world as an architect, is to take the worst problem and solve it. And, you know, because if we just write it off, it's like it's not good enough to my mind. And so I think all the architects that see this book and hear this should really be looking at this as at least part of their work, to look at these seemingly intractable problems and take those creativity and problem-solving skills that they have and apply them.
Well, I said that Mike Davis's article, Planet Slums, was very depressing to me. One of the features of people living in poverty is they themselves understandably suffer a lot of depression. Yet in your book, Building Without Borders, a word that keeps coming up both as a noun and also, is it a verb? I don't even know what part of speech, but is cooperative. People are cooperating. And usually when people are cooperating on a project, like in this case, building homes, that's usually quite a community-building and ego-boosting process. Do you find that?
I find that that's in some ways the most powerful aspect of my experience of this work is not so much. I've offered a lot of workshops on straw building and earth building and such, and people come thinking that they're going to have some technological information given to them and have a bit of practice. But what happens is people find themselves working together and developing, if only for a short period of time, a community of like-minded folks that are working together to achieve something as a common goal. And that becomes incredibly moving and powerful for people, especially in our individualistic society. And I think the same thing, especially in places where those social bonds are sometimes more powerful than what we have, that energy in itself, that human capital, if you will, can be applied to incredible effect with next to or no resources. It's just the human beings deciding that this is possible, looking around, even if it's just bits of scrap pieces of wood and sand and what have you, and just applying themselves to that problem with some help, ideally, and that's what the role of Builders Without Borders and other groups is to perhaps give that little bit of information that can be the catalytic addition to really spark something moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe Kennedy, if you would, share a story with us, perhaps of your experience in South Africa that illustrates in an anecdotal way what you were just telling us.
Well, as many of you know, South Africa is still coming out of the background of apartheid, and is still in many ways a separated country. But in going there last year, I taught a natural building and village design course, and the people who came to this course were from all the different parts of South African society, from the black to the Indian to the white South African, Afrikaans. We had a Brazilian student. We had a real miniature United Nations there. And to me, it was an incredibly challenging teaching scenario in terms of some people not having English as their first language and just culturally diverse. But when we got into it and we started to share our dreams and our hopes, and we made small models of our dream homes together, and we started to apply ourselves in a group exercise to design a village home for one of the farm workers who lived on the land where the course was being held, people came together and they started to really find each other's places of humanness and where they shared something in common and where they could help each other. And it was amazing to see who emerged as leaders who had not otherwise would have been thought of conventionally, who really learned the most, where the in this country this course became an opportunity for them to share something of themselves that had not been possible for hundreds of years, and then to apply that energy to creating a new South Africa, one that can have a socially diverse possibility and decent housing for everyone, to me, was incredibly moving, and I think for the other students that were there as well.
Hmm. When you, and this is probably maybe a little off subject, but when you see in the United States here homes being built that are ranging in square footage of, say, between 8,000 and even 25,000 square feet, and yet you've seen people attempting to build adequate housing for themselves and their community out of straw bales and mud. What does that difference, what does that bring out in you in terms of feelings?
It's definitely a frustration and a certain sadness that people are so unaware of how these choices actually do impact others around the planet. But at the same time, I have to accept that that's the way things are moving in this country. And I realized that I could rail against it and say these are bad or what have you. But instead, I've decided to be solutions-oriented, just put these ideas to the best of my ability on the ground, just show that there is another way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I've written these books that I've put together. That's why I continue to teach and speak, because I realize that providing a viable solution is much, much better than complaining about the problem.
Well, on the face of it, it would what you just said, and I was thinking a little about the difference between how we live in the West and the Northern Tier and how other people live, that it takes for granted the maldistribution of wealth in the world. So somebody can build a $25,000 home here in the Detroit area, what did I say, dollar? 25,000 square foot.
Right.
House, and then the other people are trying to learn how or relearn how to put together mud and straw bale housing.
Right.
But I guess in many ways, if one does what one can and also tries by their acts in life to be exemplary. Do you want to be known as the person, some people do, I suppose, who lives in a 25,000 square foot, do you get a motorbike or something? I don't know. How do you get around this thing? Or do you want somebody that does what you do? I guess, is that...
Well, that's a personal choice, but I've also been thinking about some creative solutions. I've had this dream of doing lifestyles of the ecological and famous or something like that, where, you know, maybe somebody like Madonna or Michael Jordan could decide to build themselves an ecological house. And many of us have talked and said that would probably do more good than all of the books and all of the conferences and all of the things put together. If somebody who has a high public presence actually stood behind these ideas and mm-hmm. said, yes, I value these and it's important.
Well, maybe I was being a little self-righteous because someone who was a slum dweller in one of these newly emerging horrible cities of Asia and Africa, they might look at my little cottage, in a Detroit suburb, and not see much difference between me and the person with 8,000, huh?
That's true, and it is very true, and that's where we as Americans, we just, if we're trying to do this work, we just have to be incredibly humble,
mm-hmm.
because that attitude is so ingrained within us. That just to go in with our Walkman or our fancy jacket or whatever, I mean, that might be more wealth than all of these people that you might be seeing can see in their entire lifetimes, just in a simple piece of machinery or something that we might even throw away when it breaks. So this, the difference is there. I mean, we need to learn more about how the realities of these other cultures operate and how they're able to survive. Because we may need to learn some of these skills ourselves with the looming specter of oil depletion and the fact that our petroleum-based society may not really be going for too much longer. We're going to have to learn a lot of what these folks that we look down upon sometimes as underdeveloped have learned to do, which is to learn to live within our local resources. And so it's something, though, that I believe can be a positive step and something that can be more joyful, more exciting, more restful even for people who live in our current society. Because really, you know, working 60 hours a week and commuting 2 hours a day to pay for a house that you're never in is not really, to my mind, really a desirable life. Yet people who look towards, through television mostly, our American lifestyle, don't really see what we have to pay for it.
Hmm.
So we're having to find ways to communicate that this isn't all it's cracked up to be.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Joseph F. Kennedy. He's edited Building Without Borders, Sustainable Construction for the Global Village. It's a series of essays, even to some extent a how-to of build with sustainable construction materials. And we really only talked about straw bales, but you also cover things like bamboo, earthen construction, adobe. Much of what is thought of as ancient material. I know when I was out in Taos, at Taos Pueblo, which I believe is the oldest continuous area dwelling in North America, and these folks would, a little section would kind of break off or you know, kind of crumble, and they would just put more adobe up on it. It seemed to work all right for them.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been there for hundreds of years, so it's sort of ironic that doing such a thing is not approved by codes now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it's incredibly ironic.
you don't ever mention wood in here. In fact, wood is kind of a no-no.
Well, it's not necessarily a no-no, and in fact, at the very end, there is an article on using round pole construction, which. Our main problem with wood is that we have plenty of wood. We just don't have a lot of really big old-growth trees anymore. So, but there's lots of saplings. There's lots of small shoots that are coming up that are crowding the forest, and yet we don't really have any way to build with those types of materials. We're dependent on the type of lumber that comes from old-growth trees. So wood, in fact, is a beautiful building material, and I don't deny that it is. It's just like anything, the improper use of other ecologically valuable resources is something that we need to address. But certainly there's people who've been working with smaller diameter round pole construction within natural building techniques to use to improve the health of the forest and use that material to serve a human need as well.
Well, we only have about 3 minutes left or so. Maybe in the time remaining you could indicate what appears in your book as to some of the other very, very interesting and actually surprising uses of natural materials and where they take place.
One of the most exciting to me is a system that's called compressed earth blocks, which uses earth, but it's compressed in either hand-powered machine or hydraulic-powered machine to make something that's very precise. So in that way, you use a local material, but you're actually able to make a building that has a very modern, clean, Western feel. That, to me, is a very exciting material and one that seems to be taking off in very many parts of the world. There's the idea of using bags filled with either soil or gravel, a very inexpensive material that can use lots of local material. One of the most exciting innovations that's come from a colleague of mine is a roof system that's called a pallet truss that is made from old pallets that are sawn apart and then glued back together to make a very inexpensive but strong roof system. There's the variety of different materials such as lime and earth and straw and various combinations that, once they're treated properly, create incredibly the most beautiful houses that you can imagine. They're not the squalid hovels that many anticipate these ideas to mean.
Well, that actually was going to be my next observation. It on one hand, it sounds like you're constructing houses of literally of junk, and on the other hand, you use the adjective beautiful to describe them. And just how does one transform? This is kind of a Cinderella story. How does this occur? Give me maybe an example.
Well, the idea is to just look to the past. Certainly, the houses that are worth a very high amount now in England and Europe and other places are made from these very same materials that we're advocating now. And they're made with thatch, they're made with earth, they're made with timber frame infilled with natural materials. And these are the houses that people are valuing very highly, and they are yet examples of the same sort of thing that we're talking about now. And so it's just a matter of perception. We can call something dirt or dirty, but when it becomes earth and it becomes a beautiful earth plaster with natural pigments and applied with a high level of craft, it becomes the sort of thing that, you know, Bill Gates will be paying for and putting in his house. So it becomes a matter of perception, really. And then seeing, too, that it's a level of human creativity and skill as well applied to these materials that brings that beauty, makes that design work, And it's an incredibly exciting time, as far as I'm concerned, to be an architect in this field, because we have this huge base of inspiration to draw upon, but yet we are still rediscovering it after a period of a couple of hundred years where the techniques have been lost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an incredible rediscovery and learning again how to make beautiful houses with whatever may be around.
Well, less than 60 seconds. Is this in any sense that kind of cliche about a race against time? On one hand, you have these slums building all over the third world. On the other hand, you have these methods now that you chronicle in your book for sustainable construction.
Well, I've had a thought about that. I've been thinking, how are we going to solve this problem? We're not going to do it one house at a time. And as part of a new initiative that I've come up with, I've come up with an idea that I call 1 Million Villages, where I thought, what if we could teach people to teach people to teach people how to build such things using the resources that they have at hand, empower local communities, empower teachers to really take on this problem and use whatever is there, but with as much of the best practices that we can collect available to them, create these beautiful villages right on the site of these so-called slums and have them become self-sufficient and self-sustaining throughout the rest of time that we need them to be there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. My guest has been Joseph F. Kennedy. The book is Building Without Borders, Sustainable Construction for the Global Village. It's published by New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, and I'll have it listed there as well. Joe Kennedy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for tuning in to the RIF's Night Call. Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio or Greater Media Detroit. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werbe. Now stay tuned for more RIF Rock, coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Okay, so my friend Jerry has this Harley that he takes really, 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 really good care of. Almost too good care, if you know what I mean.
Oh, well, yes, I do. I'm going to rub your tank. Yes, I am, you cutie, yeah.
So Jerry takes his motorcycle everywhere, drove a ton of miles, and wore down the tires.
Oh, no, Schmoofy, you're going bald. We got to get you some new tires right away.
So Jerry takes his motorcycle to Motown Harley Davidson and Taylor, where they're having a 50% off tire sale when you have them installed at Motown.
No, 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 sweetie. Those new tires don't make your rear suspension look big, and the price is so good. We're going to get you 2 cents because I love you, and you're so pretty. I want to kiss you right on the mouth.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks dig a guy on a real motorcycle.
Buy or sell your bike at Motown.
Okay?
The party is here at Leopard's Lounge in Broil. Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Every week, Leopard's Lounge brings you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. And these girls are hot. And unlike other gentlemen's clubs, which we won't even mention, Leopard's Lounge never has a cover charge, ever. They even have free parking. It's an offer you can't refuse. And this Tuesday night, don't miss Afro Man live at Leopard's Lounge. You know that because I got high, guys? Guys, you know you work hard, so you deserve a night out. Why not make it this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge for Afro Man live and enjoy the fun. Finer things in life. You know what I'm talking about. Great music, beer, and sexy, beautiful women. Hey, it just doesn't get any better. Don't miss the fun this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor, just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge in Broil.
We took TV's big dealer,
Monty Hall,
and flattened him. Right on the front of our newest instant ticket.
Let's make a deal.
That's right. Just look for Monty's picture on the Michigan Lottery's new instant game, Let's Make a Deal. When you match one number behind
door number one, door number two, or door number three,
you could win $25,000 instantly.
You deserve it.
Play Let's Make a Deal. New from the Michigan Lottery. Instant games. It's how fun is done.
Now you can enjoy all the wonderful riches of the state of Michigan.
The lakes, the rivers, the forests.
Not those kind of riches.
The kind with dollar signs.
Oh.
Thanks to Michigan Millionaire, the newest instant game from the Michigan Lottery. You can win up to $1 million instantly and up to 15 times on each ticket. And there's a Michigan multiplier that increases your winnings by 2, 5, or even 10 times. So enjoy the best of our state.
And all of its riches.
With Michigan Millionaire, new from the Michigan Lottery. Instant games. It's how fun is done.
Thank you for calling Comcast Digital Cable. Here are today's showtimes on HBO On Demand. Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, showing whenever you want. The Last Samurai, showing whenever you want. The Sopranos, showing whenever you want. NFL Replay, extended game highlights start Monday morning. Then, whenever you want. Sex and the City, showing.
Comcast Digital Cable with On Demand. Over 100 channels of family entertainment, plus a library of movies, shows, and NFL game highlights you can watch whenever you want. You can even pause, rewind, and fast forward them. Sign up now and get incredible savings on hit movies on HBO, like The Last Samurai, Mystic River, plus HBO On Demand exclusives like Sex and the City. And right now, you can get Comcast Digital Classic and HBO for only $29.99 a month for 6 months. Call 1-866-98-CABLE today. Limited time offer. Certain restrictions apply. Call Comcast for details. After promotional period, regular monthly charges apply.
That time again. It's fall. Kids are in school. Hey, I'm screaming Scott Randall from 101 WRIF. Ever thought about a career in radio or television? Ever thought, hey, I could do that? Well, at the Spech Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan, you can. Looking back to when I attended Spech Howard School, I remember hands-on experience with the latest technology in the studio and in the classroom. Teachers and staff that will work with you one-to-one. Heck, Spech even assisted me in getting my first job. They challenge you to learn. And the best part about it, it was fun. There's classes to fit most schedules. Financial aid is available to those who qualify. Deadline is November 1st. But classes are filling fast. Don't wait to call or you might miss the class you want most. Get the jump start on a new career. Trust me, school can be fun. Call 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. The Spech Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan. This is where you start. It's where I started.
More Riff Rock with Tiny Tim.
SBC, going beyond the call.
Pay attention, boys. Back to the rock.
Quicker than anybody.
Why ain't that like being too ethical?
101 WRIF. Riff.
Hi, this is Ryan from Nickelback, and you're rocking with 101 WRIF. If it rocks, it's on the riff.